did send us a list of your delegation, and we are appreciative of the delegation that you have here. Maybe as we go along, you can inform us, you can introduce the delegation to us. But before I ask you to start with your presentation, and really a hearty welcome to all of you here, and thank you very much for responding to our request. I think we've been trying a while now to have yourself appear before us. Before we ask you to start your presentation, we first of all want to take the opportunity to convey to the university, both to the leadership, the students, their leadership, and everyone at Stellenbosch, we want to convey to you our heartfelt condolences in the passing of, I think it was Hannah Cornelius. We absolutely share the pain of what has indeed has happened to the young bright student at your college, and we are concerned that you know, the level of violence seem to be increasing, and I thought you should mention a little bit more to us also in this regard, because we are concerned with what is happening. We also wish that I think there's another student that are still recovering. What's his name? Cheslin? Cheslin Mars. We convey our best wishes to the other student also in a speedy recovery. You would have noticed that insofar as Hannah and her family is concerned, I serve on the Magistrates Commission also, and her father is a magistrate too. So our deputy minister has gone to the family and have gone to express condolences as part of the legal fraternity. And I trust that also brought some comfort to the family. So we thought that we wanted to express these words of comfort first before you do your presentation. I take it, honourable members, you would share the sentiments that I expressed and conveyed to the university and its family. I am going to hand over to yourself if you are ready.
There's a problem with the display. Find someone.
Do you have, honourable members, do you have the handout?
No?
Because I wanted to find out if you have the handout. If you have the handout, honourable members, then I ask that whilst they're fixing the problem, that you could speak to the handout that we have. Can I find that on board members? Do you all have the handout? No? No? Kadiming, I saw this is what it looks like.
Yes. It seems to me there are two documents.
It's like a booklet.
Is this booklet that you caught, but there's also the presentation that university is just now distributing.
There we go. I'm asking honourable members that we don't wait for somebody to come and fix this, that the presentation be done and we follow it on the... Please give the documents to the secretary.
They will assist. I have that.
Okay. Over to yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity of being here, and thank you very much for the welcome, and also for the sincere wishes expressed to the university. We really appreciate that. So by way of introduction, I'm just quickly going to ask the members of our delegation, as I name them, to raised their hand. So it's myself, Wim de Villiers. I'm the Rector and Vice-Chancellor, Professor Nico Koopman, Vice-Rector of Social Impact, Transformation and Personnel, Professor Arnold Schoenwinkel, Vice-Rector of Learning and Teaching, Ms. Nicolette van den Eickel, Chief Director of Facilities Management, and then we have three SRC members, Lynn Shea Julies, who will be presenting, Maxwell Mslangeni, Liana Letabo-Mahesu, Dr. Adelbert Scholz, who is the Deputy Chair of the IF, Mr. Wade Davidson, who is the Secretary of the Institutional Forum, Professor Peter van der Walt, the Vice Chair of Council, Mr. Victor Matobi, the Chief Director of Human Resources, Mr. Sello Molapo, who is the Manager of Human Resources, Dr. Jerome Slamat, Executive Manager in the Rectorate, and Mr. Desmond Thompson, who's our Senior Communications Specialist, who's trying his utmost to get the presentation going. So, but it's good to be here. We've had previous meetings on the 1st of September 2015 in Parliament and also the 16th of March 2016 on the Stellenbosch campus. So we welcome this opportunity to engage with a very important stakeholder in this wonderful constitutional democracy of ours. We have great respect for the oversight role of Parliament as exercised through this portfolio committee, and Stellenbosch University is a proud public institution. We're a national asset, and that is, it will become very clear in our presentation. Turning to slide 2 and on the presentation that you have that was also sent out or provided to you now, is this is our third meeting in 3 years with the portfolio committee, so we will get right to the point. Our presentation directly addresses 5 issues that the committee raised in our letter of invitation. 5 issues: transformation, staff demographics, language policy, student housing, and safety and security. So each of these areas will be unpacked by a member of our management team, and then our statutory bodies, the SRC, the IF, and Council, will provide their perspective. We aim to be quite brief. We would like to be around about 50 minutes or so in total, and that will hopefully leave enough time for some meaningful discussion to take us forward as institutions serving the public. So on slide 3,
My apologies. So you would do the first presentation,
yes.
Then we go to the SRC.
No, then we're going
to go to the IF.
I'll take you through it.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair. So I refer you to the documentation that we've brought along just for more background. So this includes, you have an overview of 2016 at Stellenbosch University. So that is it's quite comprehensive, but it's a synopsis of the relevant pieces of our annual report. So that's an overview of 2016. We also brought along a pamphlet on our research chairs and the centers of excellence, and then also importantly, statements on issues that have made the headlines recently, specifically the brutal murder of one of our students, Ms. Cornelius, outside Stellenbosch, and also the display of Nazi-like posters on our Stellenbosch campus earlier this month. So all these documents contain more detail than we can cover in the time at our disposal, but I want to highlight a few issues. So looking back on 2016, certainly hashtag Fees Must Fall Part 2 affected the whole sector, and it also had an impact on us. So on the one hand, we grappled with opening the doors of higher learning, but not allowing financial challenges to get in the way of developing human potential. But also, on the other hand, very importantly, not to lose sight of our core business as a university, which is to generate useful knowledge and produce empowered graduates and make a positive societal impact. So perhaps the most important lesson learned that we learned as a university is that adversarial relationships are really lose-lose relationships, and they have high costs for all parties. And we've really, in a very deliberate sense, decided to make 2017 a year of meaningful engagement with all our stakeholders, and I believe we've had some success in that regard. The challenges we face as a university and as a sector are significant, as you can see. Free, decolonized education, we are continuously grappling. What does that exactly mean, if one unpacks that? Systemic sustainability, especially financial, systemic transformation, safety on campus, and student housing. And my colleagues will cover some of these areas in their presentation. So, members of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, I have to be honest, the past 2 years have been really tough and complex. But I believe we've made excellent progress by getting a number of important policies approved, such as our new language policy, an employment equity policy, a new admissions policy, a policy on unfair discrimination and harassment, and a new student disciplinary code. And we have a solid foundation in place, and I believe we've established and put together a strong management team, which has really been expanded and diversified to give us really the best shot at going forward. So we have achieved considerable success in all three areas of our core business, as you can see in the overview that we provided, in terms of research and innovation, record numbers of PhDs and master degrees and research outputs, innovation, learning and teaching, social impact. You have the examples in front of you. And that's really, it comes to the point that Stellenbosch University makes a really a valuable contribution as a national asset. We're rooted in Africa, but we have a global reach. And I will now hand over to the rest of the team. I'll provide a brief conclusion at the end, and we will start with Professor Nico Koopman, the Vice Rector for Social Impact, Transformation, and Personnel. Nico?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rector. I will speak on the transformation process with reference to the transformation plan and the summit resolutions. Chair, first of all, we make the point that we're making good progress with establishing systemic transformation. In other words, that we say transformation is not relegated and isolated and marginalized to be in one corner, in one transformation office. But all facets and aspects of the university must be in transformation mode. We also emphasize the fact that our rector in his inaugural address 2 years ago emphasized, namely, that we talk about transformation in two ways. It's on the one hand the transformation of the institution that is crucial, but that we also talk about the transformative role that Stellenbosch University must play in society, and specifically that we have the task as a public university to enhance the goals of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, with specific reference to a life of dignity, healing, justice, freedom, and equality for all. We talk about transformation as quantitative transformation, referring to specific targets that you set regarding diversity, for instance, but also qualitative transformation. And here we refer especially to the transformation of the institutional culture, of our corporate personality as an institution, our collective and communal culture and character. Transformation is a top-level priority for the institution. We have appointed now permanently a vice rector for transformation. On the 1st of July, a senior director for transformation will also commence duties. The transformation office is a budgetary priority. We staff it, we're extending the infrastructure, and we're glad to report that this office has very strong institutional buy-in. We have a new institutional transformation committee with representatives of all faculties and all support services, and this committee guides, directs, monitors, assesses, and also proposes interventions where necessary regarding transformation. In March this year, the Senate unanimously adopted our transformation plan, and this plan to a high extent reflects the resolutions of the October 2015 Transformation Summit, and it's also guided by the draft barometer for transformation at higher institutions of higher education. Then I move to the summit resolutions. You ask that we specifically indicate how we make progress with addressing this. I already mentioned that it's included in our plan, but just a few more examples or specific examples. We really try to address, to make the motto no financial exclusion where there is academic merit true, and we can report that this is really materialized to a high extent at our university. Then you ask about the institutional forum, where there were resolutions about the transformative role of the institutional forum, and we can say they are involved in senior appointments, and later their vice chair will report how they also involved in the transformation committee and the employment equity committee of the university, for example. Then regarding the diversification of council and also the rector's management team, we can report that the minister now may appoint 5 representatives into the council, and that will enhance diversity. And also the management team had been enlarged and diversified in terms of gender and color. We address the institutional culture as mandated by our summit of 2015, and one of the avenues we follow is that we have on campus established staff and student courses to develop transformation competency, and that impacts positively on our institutional culture. Regarding curriculum renewal that was decided upon at the summit, we can say we have a task team for curriculum renewal which specifically focuses on the theme of decolonization, and we're also in the process of developing modules, compulsory modules that will enhance the transformation competency of our students. And we have just established also now a new task team for visual redress to look at all our public symbols, our buildings, and other important public symbols on campus. Just a brief remark in conclusion about transformation is that, Chair, we can report that the transformation plan, and we're excited about this, serves as a compass on campus for all our activities, all our policies, and all our practices. And I mentioned some of the crucial policies there that is strongly informed by the transformation plan. This brings me to staff demographics. You have on the 10th slide our staff, current staff headcount by race. You have the figures there, and also by function, academic staff, and also the professional administrative support and service staff. You have both sets of figures there. You can see how it is. 53% white, 8% African, 37% colored, and 2% Indian in terms of race. And then our ratio between PAS and academic staff is 68 and 32. Then we also have the academic figures there for you. For our academic staff, we broke it down so you could can see where one of our big challenges at Stellenbosch and at other institutions are. We have 76% white, and then 8 African, and then colored 13, and Indian 3. And with regard to the PAS compilation, you can see there the figures are clearly also indicated. White 43, colored 48, African 8%, and Indian 1%. Then the gender figures we also present to you, Chair. You can see there the total figures, 57 female and 43 male. If you look at the PAS, there it is. 62 female and 38% male, and then in the academic sector, then female 47 and male 53. We can conclude, if you look at this specific, the next slide, that we over the last 3 years, and if we, as soon as we get the latest figures, we will see a further steady growth, steady and resolute growth with regard to diversification in all these categories. Maybe I should say something about our objectives regarding staff diversification. It is for us important that we must accelerate the diversification of our staff corps. Therefore, we engaged on the career advancement of our African, colored, and Indian staff. You are by now aware of the Rector Strategic Personnel Fund that we had established, and we can report that it is really bearing fruit. We could make in total 27 new appointments from the categories mentioned there, and we could also support the promotion of staff, six staff members, senior staff members in the ACI category. That's one measure that we use. The second one is the NGAP program, the New Generation of Academics program, that help us also to accelerate staff diversification at our institutions and specifically also at Stellenbosch. And here we can report clearly that we, in the first two phases, had appointed 9 colleagues, and we this year could also, we are in the process now of appointing 2 more colleagues. The last set of remarks here, Madam Chair, is that we at the moment set the target for 2020 that we want 53% African colored and Indian staff members at the institution. We are currently at 47. And regarding gender, we have the target to have 60% women staff members by 2020. And as you could see earlier, we're at 57 now. Here we should mention the specific challenge that we have, namely that we, in competition with the corporate sector for the expertise that is in the country, but we also in competition with other institutions of higher education for the still too limited pool of academics and other staff from designated groups. So we need strong measures to build our limited pool and to enhance diversification. And one of the big measures that I also want to emphasize is our employment equity process. We had adopted a new EE policy last year and also a new EE plan. All our faculties have now their own employment equity plans. We have an institutional employment equity forum and a full-time also employment equity manager who is also present here today. So we know that by enhancing the EE process, we will also enhance our diversification. But we must, in the same instance, we must also make sure that we grow the pool of expertise and programs then, like the NGAP and the Rector Strategic Personnel Fund, research grant, learning and teaching grants, mentoring grants, doctoral scholarships, postdoctoral scholarships, which we call Consolidocs, and our African Doctoral Academy are all avenues that we use to really grow the pool, the knowledge pool in our country. Madam Chair, I leave it there, and during question times, one could perhaps say more.
Professor Skolboko.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable members of the PPC. I will address two topics. One is the language policy development in the recent years and implementation, and the second topic would be student housing. Since we met last time with the PPC, where we had a situation where Afrikaans was experienced by some of our students as enabling, but experienced by some other students as exclusionary, excluding them, the Council has adopted a very important motion on 30th of November 2015, and I've copied it for you there. Afrikaans as a language may never be a hindrance to any student who wants to undertake undergraduate or postgraduate study at Stellenbosch University. who does not have the full command of Afrikaans. Council therefore requests management in November 2015 to create the necessary mechanisms with a view to this and to monitor them continuously. If this should mean that English academic offering exceeds the stated target, this will have the support of target. That's initiated a process which happened in the first 6 months of last year, where Stellenbosch University management decided in February to initiate a task team to review the language policy. By March of last year, we had a draft policy on the table, which was put out for public consultation for a month. And on that phase, we received more than 500 inputs and comments from the public, as well as people inside the university and other stakeholders. A work group worked continuously in the first 6 months of last year, and then developed further drafts, which was put to the faculty boards in May 2016 for the inputs, and that final draft was approved by the Institutional Forum and Senate in June of last year, and approved by Council on the 22nd of June. Thereafter followed in the second half of last year the implementation plans by the faculties, and the new policy kicked in on the start of classes of this year. And to fulfill our obligation of monitoring what the experience is of the new policy, we sent out a poll in March, that is 2 months after the classes started, to estimate and to determine how do the students actually experience the new language policy. I will come back to that in a moment. But what is this new multilingual policy actually entail? The point of departure is that the new multilingual policy should enable access to Stellenbosch University's knowledge offering via a preferred language of the students in accordance of our South African Constitution, Clause 27.2. It was also chosen to be multilingual, focusing on giving access via the three official languages of our region, Afrikaans, English, and isiXhosa. We have put significant financial support behind the implementation of this policy, for instance, doubling up classes to teach in parallel medium and to provide real-time interpretation in some instances. So the modes of teaching, which I've put out there, are the following three. Parallel medium, but note that to avoid language separation, the tutorials of modules which are taught in parallel medium again integrate students across the language groups at our university. The second mode, which is widely used, is where we use both English and Afrikaans to the same class group. And the principle there is all information conveyed must at least be conveyed in English, with emphasizing and summarizing in Afrikaans for those students who find that beneficial. And the third mode is where we use a single language, Afrikaans and English, and if we do that, we provide real-time interpretation, at least in all first-year modules, so that students can, as far as practically possible, have access to our knowledge base via their preferred language of instruction. The point is, I think that our multilingual offering at Stellenbosch University is now one of the distinctive characteristics of how we teach at this university compared to other universities in South Africa. Let me briefly talk about the results of the language implementation survey that we had in March. That's 2 months after we initiated the new policy. And first, on the out-of-class environment, we polled all 19,500, almost 20,000 undergraduate students in a survey, and we got an excellent response rate of 24%. And the main question that we asked to them, okay, how do they respond to this question? I feel included where there is communication in the following environments: the living environment, the co-curricular environment, or when we offer administrative support services. And the first blocks on those three bars that I show you are responses from students say, I strongly agree that I am fully included, or I agree or I am neutral. And you will see that more than 75% of the students now with the new policy feel included in what we offer.
And the same happens what in the class by using the multilingual offering, that students say, we experienced that what you said you would do is actually what happens in the classroom. Moving on to my second topic, Chair, is about student housing. And one of the other transformative initiatives that we undertook is to review our policy for placement in residences, because we know that that is one of the environments where we can really contribute to student success, should a student be placed in a residence in company of other students for support. The second point I'm making there is it's an opportunity to put students from diverse communities together, and by that I mean not only integrating students in residences, but also the day students by means of what we call the cluster concept, where we lump a number of private entities and residency entities together in a cluster. We also see that our residences are a place where we can accommodate the most vulnerable students and thereby increase their chances of academic success. This then is an instrument to ensure our diversity objectives with regard to African, colored, and Indian students at an undergraduate level. So what is the composition of our students demographically in our residences? I've shown you a few graphs there by means of bars. First of all, the top one says in our overall residence capacity, which is about 7,500 beds, overall at Stellenbosch University, about 48% of the accommodation is taken up by African, colored, and Indian students, and about 52% by white students. We can disaggregate that on the Tigerberg campus, where we have our medicine and health sciences students. Senior housing would be for students in their fifth year and beyond of the medical studies, or students older than 22 years. And you will see that most of the students in senior housing are from the African, colored, Indian communities, and the rest for white students. Same applies at Tigerberg for the junior housing, that's first to fourth year. And then I've also shown you the figures for Stellenbosch campus, for senior housing and for junior housing. I think this, the numbers of the students by demographic grouping, shows that we can not only assist students to learn to function with each other socially, but also support each other academically. Let me briefly, by the way, the sum works out that 40% of all our undergraduate students stay in residences at Stellenbosch University, 40%. So projects that we were able to complete last year with the assistance of funding from the Department of Higher Education and Training is a new 208-bed residence on the Tigerberg campus. And this year we will complete the following, another 200-bed residence in Tigerberg campus, which enable us to bring about 54 students who are in a residence off campus onto campus housing. That's the so-called Kerkenberg residence, which we have ministerial approval to sell that facility and accommodate the students directly inside Tigerberg campus perimeters. We are doing many other things that enhances the students' experience in residence, for instance, upgrade of bathrooms, upgrade of dining rooms, improving Wi-Fi connectivity. And my last slide there, Chairperson, what are the projects in planning? Yet, on main campus, another 200-bed residence at the so-called Goldfields complex, a new dining room in that same complex, a new hub at one part of our complex. Now, hub is a facility where students from the private grouping and students relations get together to socialize and to study in groups. And we will be building our third hub on campus at that location. And one of our older residences, a large one, will be upgraded starting in 2018. Thank you, Chair.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. Safety and security of our students across all our campuses is, of course, our primary concern. Having an open campus, particularly in Stellenbosch, has some major challenges to it. You referred to the terrible tragedy that occurred this past weekend, And that obviously has major implications for our community, also has implications on how we respond operationally, and also creates expectations from our community and how we deal with that. We present to you the figures for security in 2016. There was a marked increase in student in crime-related incidents at the beginning of 2016 compared to 2015, and that was largely due to the fact that we didn't have enough feet on the ground due to issues around the outsourced security provision. But criminal activities on our other student campuses are very low. We had an additional amount of security on campus during the Fees Must Fall protests, but we were able to reduce those for this year. So as you will see, I indicated to you that the first half of 2016 was very high, direct consequence of not feet on the ground, but towards the end of the year we managed to redeploy security staff again. And you can see that the numbers were much lower than previous years. Our four security pillars that we try to manage is, number one is we've got a huge in-house security staff, which is supported by contracted professionals, which allows us to provide a 24/7 service. And that service will increase or decrease depending on the activities on campus. Exam times, we have more people on the ground doing what we call a pedestrian escort service, for example. We also have a very sophisticated operations center with backed up by a large network of technology. We have over 1,000 cameras on the campus and around the campus. For example, it was very beneficial to SAPS this past weekend, and they accessed our information already on Saturday morning early and allowed us to work quickly on that case. We also realize that we need to have an informed and active and vigilant campus community, so we work closely with student affairs and the student communities to make sure that we constantly reiterate messages around safety and security to the community to remind them what are good behaviors and what they can do in cases of emergency. And importantly, also, we have strategic partnerships with SAPS, very good working relationships with the municipal law enforcement, the public prosecutor's office, and various community crime prevention forums within Stellenbosch and Tigerberg. Some of the specific safety initiatives that we have: Stellenbosch University was a founding member of the Stellenbosch Security Initiative. This is where we've very much operationally involved with the town and the crime prevention bodies in the town. We also have the Mayor Rector Forum, and out of the Mayor Rector Forum is a monitoring and advisory committee on crime. It's in places like this that we deal with the issue of the tragedy, discuss ways of making sure that we mitigate our risks in the town as much as possible. We also have a nighttime shuttle service that students can use to move around campus. We have very successfully this past year implemented what is an anti-mugging patrol or a mobile reaction unit where two units move around campus during the night, either apprehending people or advising students about safe behaviors. We have student safety committees that we're very grateful for that are operating very well this year under the leadership of this SRC. We've also upped our traditional and social media to make sure that we make people aware of risks and good behavior. And then we've also increased our criminal intelligence capacity and our investigation capacity so that we can assist SAPS in resolving cases as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Good morning to all members and to the chair. Firstly, I will speak on the language, specific student communities, and we'll focus on language. It is quite a concern for the SRC that only 24% of students completed the survey, and therefore we decided that it is really important to make awareness of the language policy and the implementation plans of each faculty. Because what we've realized is, through the statistics, is that students don't know where to complain or where queries need to go. So this is why we have then, together with other structures from the SLC, started a plan where we will create a awareness sort of week through social media. We have included as well the campaign of awareness of YEMIS, which we know YEMIS is quite important in on our university. So these two campaigns will run together at the start of the semester. Through that, we have also sort of encouraged all our faculty committees to make sure that students are aware of what the language plans is for each faculty. Because we have realized that while the language policy is on the university, the language implementation plans are not accessible to many students, and it would have to be done through request. So that is the first thing. Then secondly, the Department of Higher Education and ANESA's meeting. So the SFC has been actively been involved with other SRCs in the Western Cape. They have met with the DHET to raise concerns specifically on the ground of what is happening in terms of students. These concerns include sort of the SPAC system that is hoping to start, and as well as the centralization of the NESFA systems. So there is also another concern of the LAS, so it is the forms that students need to sign to receive their funding. And what has happened is that this date has been so early in the year, it means that students could be excluded if these forms are not signed ahead of time. So what happened is that we responded and we requested that this date be expanded to a later time. And we then received some commitment from them, but we have not received response, like formal response that we can send to students to say that this will occur. And currently students are sort of panicking on what can happen. And we would like that not to happen because it can create hostility among the students. Then thirdly, in terms of NESPA centralization, at the start of the year, with the centralization of NESPA starting this year, it was quite a concern because with sending through names later than what the university started meant, a lot of problems trickled down for the student. So, for example, I will make that if a student did not receive an answer that they have accepted for NESPA's funding for the year, it meant that they could not be placed in a residence. This means some students who came from different places in South Africa came there with bags and ready to get into accommodation, but they were not able to. So what the SLC then done is that they assisted with my use of like backpacker systems. We're also currently working on sort of initiating a plan and a policy that will sort of prevent such measures at the start of the year. Another thing is where students who have historical debt came forward and were not yet accepted, or the names were not sent to the university as well. This means that they could not register, because if you have historical debt, you cannot register. And this was then raised to management, and a task team was created, and we somehow assisted about 30-plus students that approached us to register for the start of the year, despite having the historical debt. So that was quite a win for us. On the next slide, in terms of safety and security, I will first, on your request, Chair, speak about the incident of Hannah and Chislin. The SLC has made it our mission to sort of also take care of Chislin as well, who is still in hospital. We have met with the Dean of the Faculty to see if there is any academic concession and sort of support for the student in some way. The Dean of the Faculty has assured that the student will be supported in every way possible. And then in terms with Hannah, it is quite a shock for the university and for the students at large. This has then created students to sort of start social media platforms such as WhatsApp, such as Facebook pages, and students have started to take the initiative for themselves. So the SLC has then decided to take support of these student leadership initiatives. Like, for example, today there will be a meeting of all the student leaders on campus, and they will discuss on student initiatives that they can work on to assist management and staff in the sense to work on the safety and security at Stellenbosch. The SLC will then tomorrow night also host a vigil for Hannah that has passed. The vigil will also be in remembrance of the two students have the university has recently lost. While the vigil is on, then I request that in the evening for yourselves, maybe just send a thought out to the parents and to the family as well. If you could light a candle, that would be really supportive, and it will be encouraging for the family where you are. Then our next point on request for a safety colloquium, which will be organized by the SLC. With safety and security is such an issue on Stellenbosch University because it is such an open space and it is an open residential town. So the SLC's aim is then to work with the police and the municipality to work on initiatives and of ideas and to refine what each body can do in terms of safety and security on the campus. The aims basically include just to include the stakeholders, because what we have realized is that because it is a residential town, it is difficult to differentiate what is a Stellenbosch University issue and what is a community municipality issue. So we will look at policies and we'll look at the roles of how we can assist the students into this colloquium. Apart from that, it is also really important for us to acknowledge the support and to basically acknowledge that all that has been done through management. However, we do believe that more could be done because we believe safety and security does not fully include physical safety and security, but as well as mental and academic. So through this colloquium, we will also then look at those kind of issues and we'll look at how we can assist students, because what we have seen and realized that academic and mental issues have been increasing amongst our students on campuses, and we hope that the university management, the municipality and police in some way will be able to assist us. And that's all for us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's people forum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Institutional Forum is a statutory body. We are created in terms of the Higher Education Act. Our main task is to provide advice to management and council regarding all policy documents, as well acting as a watchdog regarding discrimination. And that leads us to the next slide. We are actively involved in transformation at the university. There's a representative of the IF on the transformation committee of Professor Koopman, and we have this topic high on our agenda, and in that regard we played an active role in policy documents regarding admission of students, the language policy, student housing, and so forth. And our task is to see whether these policy documents are acceptable, legal, and so forth. Next slide. We recognize that all the available talent in South Africa has to be developed. It doesn't matter where it comes from. If this country has to go forward, all the talent has to be developed. And that also means that we've got to employ all the available talent in teaching staff and so forth. We don't want to be exclusive in any way. But then we also realize that there are certain stumbling blocks. The pool of available candidates for admission as students or employment as teaching staff is not always as big as we would like it to be. But we are working in that direction to improve that situation as soon as possible. We regularly have discussions and feedback to management, quite a number of things that we've taken up with them, including the satisfaction of students who are not in residences. We also discussed safety and security during these demonstrations regarding fees must fall, the legal obligations of the university towards and students. We discussed those type of things. And of course, the transformation plan was high on our agenda. So it is a body that works well. Although there's other universities where it is almost non-existent. We've got a very competent and motivated chairman, Mr. Leroux Burrows. I must mention that. And our meetings are really pleasant occasions where representatives from management, from the teaching staff, from the administrative staff, students, and the community can meet and discuss issues that have to be taken further on. Thank you, Mrs. Chair.
Honourable members, I stand in for our chairman, Mr. George Stain, who tenders his apologies because he couldn't make it today. I want to give you a perspective from the council's point of view, and our perspective is that the university has made steady and, I think, impressive progress on its transformation journey. In the past year, important new policies have been adopted, including a new policy that supports our ideal of multilingualism and, in practice, enabled us to reach a point where we do not exclude any student who is not proficient in Afrikaans. And I regard that as a big breakthrough. It was arrived at after careful balancing of the constitutional rights of all our students, and we did not neglect the vested rights of the Afrikaans community, but we opened up the university to students who are not proficient in Afrikaans. We also have a new admissions policy that enables the management of diversity and a new employment equity policy that advances the diversification of staff. Coming back to the language policy, the modes used there are parallel medium instruction, where a lecture is given in Afrikaans in parallel with a lecture given in English. Students are free to choose, so Afrikaans-speaking students often choose to sit in the English class. That's quite allowable. This is especially used in the first year to help students adapt to the rather hectic pace of study at the university. We were also sensitive to not separating our campus into race or language groups. So the integration of students, as Professor Schoenwinkel said, takes place in the tutorial classes where students are helped individually in the language of their choice. In multilingual languages where Afrikaans and English is used, all material in lectures is presented in at least English, but with emphasis and summary in Afrikaans. This ensures that students not proficient in Afrikaans are not excluded, but importantly also, broad support is available for those students who are not sufficiently proficient in English. You tend to find that students from the Northern Cape have very little exposure to English, and they need support to adapt to the university life. For many decades, Stellenbosch has used English language handbooks, and the help is there to help these students to read the prescribed material. Where possible, we also provide support in isiXhosa, for instance, with translations of technical terms into isiXhosa. For students' benefit. Professor Schoenwinkel reported on an extensive survey that has confirmed that the new policy is very well attuned to the needs of the university. And although the response rate was 24.7%, which actually is a high response rate for a survey, it showed that the policy is attaining the goals. It's well received in the university community. Where there is criticism of the new policy, it's mostly from outside the university, from people who are not involved in the university's business. Our legal advisors assure us that this new language policy brings us fully aligned to the requirements of the Constitution and all relevant legislation. And I think this is something we can be proud of, the progress we made in this regard. The new admissions policy provides mechanisms to promote diversity. Now, academic merit always remains the most important driver for admission, and also minimum entry requirements are strictly enforced. We have a process, as outlined in the graphic there, where a first placement is done solely on academic merit. And interestingly, we nowadays find that many black students get entry to the university on this first round, where nothing but academic merit is taken into account. But then, because of historical reasons, we have a second selection where the Asian, Indian, colored students are now form a new list, and from those we select once again according to academic merit. We've also established a third class of students that get a turn next, and those are the socioeconomic students with a low socioeconomic status, for instance from disadvantaged backgrounds, from first quartile schools. We make provision for them, and we also, once again, according to academic merit, can allow give access to those students. These numbers are still relatively small because these students are expensive students to take in. They need a lot of support financially, they need support for housing, and they need extra academic support. So those numbers are very much limited by the capacity to handle these students. Regarding student protests, we handled student the university handled student protests firmly but with empathy in 2016. This enabled the management to keep the academic program running on time. This did not just happen, it was managed that way. A record number of academic qualifications were awarded, including record numbers of master's degrees and doctorates. We handled the teething problems with the NSFAS bursaries by providing emergency funding to provide bridging finance where bursaries did not come through in time, and thereby mitigated against possible student protest. Stellenbosch managed the demand for insourcing effectively and fairly by developing a concept called viable sourcing, and we managed to get to a fair conclusion without incurring a crippling and unsustainable financial burden for the university. The lines of communication to students are open and actively nurtured, and if you remember what gave us an invitation to this committee in 2015, I think we can say ons luister. So Stellenbosch University is making steady progress towards being a world-class institution with an open and welcoming campus culture. The university is well managed and working hard to become even more efficient. Financial sustainability is an all-important priority, but we must confess that the state subsidy isn't quite quite adequate, and these problems are becoming more difficult year by year to handle. And just once again to record that in 2016, Stellenbosch University awarded a very large percentage of South Africa's postgraduate qualifications to African, colored, and Indian students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Professor van der Walt. So, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, we attempted to provide you with this overview. You got the documentation for the 2016 overview, and specifically focusing on the five areas that you wanted us to address: transformation, staff demographics, language policy, student housing, safety and security. So, in conclusion, Stellenbosch University will be celebrating its centenary next year. So we formally became a public university by an act of this parliament in 1918. It was in the same act that University of Cape Town was also formally became a public university, and I'm always reminded by a previous registrar of UCT, UA Moore, that University of Cape Town is actually 15 minutes older than Stellenbosch University. But 1918, that was a different time, a different country. We have all certainly come a long way, but we have a long way to go still. And for our university, the golden thread we are pursuing has two strands. It has excellence on the one hand, and it has relevance, local relevance, regional impact, global competitiveness. And yes, we're incomplete, an incomplete journey, imperfect, but we are committed to this journey of transformation with our stakeholders. I believe we're making progress. It's important that we keep going in the interests of our students, our staff, the whole university community, and the South African society. So thank you. Back to you, Chair.
I thank the management for their presentation, the SRC, the Institutional Forum, as well as the Council for your presentation. Before I hand over to the members to ask questions, may I inquire whether the Portfolio Committee will be invited to the centenary? And may I inquire which month it will be? And may I remind you, it will be the year that Nelson Mandela would be 100 years old also. That's why I'd like to know which month it will be. Quick response.
So, Chair, you most definitely will be invited. It's going to be a year-long celebration, but the act was actually signed on the 2nd of April, 1918, and that's in the Easter weekend. So, but we will do it throughout the year, starting in probably in March.
Okay. All right. We shall await the official one. Honourable Killian, Honourable Zoli, Honourable Bata, Honourable van der Westhuizen, Kadiming, Kekana, Kunu, please remember the way I have allocated you.
Actually, I wanted to ask just a five-minute leg break, please, Jay. Can we please just have that?
The members are looking at you with very frowned faces. Permission denied. Honourable Bazzoli.
Thanks, Chair. Just a few questions. I'm fascinated that even though 57% of your staff are women, you want to actually increase that to over 60%. Why? It seems now you're going in the other direction from proper, you know, balanced gender relations, and you're going to start disadvantaging men. So, and I'm serious. It's actually a problem. Secondly, I'd like to ask you to comment on the quality of the interpretation in the lectures. because I do seem to remember that I know that the Leicester video was not actually all about Stellenbosch University. It was about the college, the agricultural college. But one of the complaints in that college was that the quality of the interpretation was such that having simultaneous translation really didn't help the students. So I'd like to ask maybe if you could comment on that. And then I also wonder how you are managing the diversity in residences. It sounds very promising that you are ensuring that there's no exclusive res, you know, that as has emerged in some of the universities where there are some reses that are exclusively for one kind of person and others that are exclusively for another kind of person. But managing diversity is difficult. It's not easy. You don't just stick people together and then they will mix. People form their own little subgroups anyway, even though they may have a room next to one another. So I'm wondering what positive steps you take to ensure that the res diversity actually turns into real diverse interaction. And then lastly, all of these things that you've had to add, all of these new security measures, insourcing measures, patrols, shuttles, heaven only knows what. I'm just wondering how much all of this is costing. Because increasingly what we find is that institutions are having to take over expenses that should be covered by the state. In other words, cities should be safe. Shouldn't it be our job to make them safe or your job to make them safe? So this is costing money, and I'm wondering how much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much to the team Stellenbosch for the presentation. I will shoot straight. This is the third time that you have met the portfolio committee on the occasions that you have tabulated, and your chairperson have consistently been missing. Is there any special reasons why your chairperson is not available for these occasions? I'm going to ask a question that will reflect on most of the things that you do. Institutional culture is actually not a one-way street. You put plans, and then those plans have to be reflected on by those that are participating in them and those that are implemented to benefit. It may be too early in the day, but I would like maybe to get the indications of how you actually or attractively try to sparkle the responses of those that benefit from the plans of the institutional culture. Because the implementation of the institutional culture has to also to give reflection to early warning signs so that there could be dynamic, there could be accommodative of the environment, but most importantly, there could be redirective to the benefits of what is intended, which means stick to the plan, be modest with the implementation, reflect on the beneficiaries, and see if it's going according to plan. Stellenbosch is a university that requires extensive reorientation into the truly diversified South African university. And in fact, if you do it correctly, you can be one of those who have had an exceptional opportunity to do the right things, because when we call for a truly diversified South African university, some do what we call a cut and paste job, which end up reflecting badly on either labor, student, or what I will call the future community plans. You will find that something doesn't just sink right. And people can see through you if you actually lie about
your plans. I am also particularly concerned about the nature of the higher education growth in terms of junior lecturers, senior lecturers, the meeting of the plans around African females, colored females, black men in particular. One of the best sustainable ways has been growing your own team. I noticed what the Vice Chancellor and probably the Council has advised the Vice Chancellor to do. But central to that, the biggest investment is your own students. Your students doing honors, because there is no trick in this. You can't go outside and expect people who are fearful of your culture to immediately join you. So your first segments of recruits should be your honors students, honors, masters, PhD, because at least those ones have endured a little bit of patience with your troubles. They've understood, they've tended to love and hate certain things, and maybe they can stay longer. Those who come from outside will reject you immediately when things get tougher. So that's my advice to you. You may not pay for it, but the invoice is still there.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to link on to what Honorable Mbatha has been asking. Minister Nzimande has on numerous occasions expressed his concern about the growth in senior academic staff from designated groups. And I would appreciate it if the delegation from Stellenbosch could just inform us of the steps. Do they have particular steps to support the careers of academics from the designated groups? Then secondly, if we could just be informed about the rate of students that eventually register. We do know that in many institutions there's quite a difference between the number of students that inquire and that apply and that then eventually turn up to register. And perhaps with reference to this current year's registration figures and are the trends that you have shown us, has that been maintained for the 2017 academic year? And then lastly, Chairperson, and to the delegation, I can just say we are currently considering the various budget votes of government. We've had the debates, presidency's one will be this afternoon, and I think it's no secret that there's huge frustration that we are voting for literally eventually billions of rand for the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. And yet it seems from what you've just shared with us in brief, Ms. Julius, that it has again led to some tension and anxiety amongst students. We obviously get presentations from NSFAS where they tell us that, you know, all these systems are in place, and yes, they've been caught unawares in December and they had to get extra 20 capturers and so on. But, you know, we just get the beautiful picture of how SBUCs will be paid right into students' bank accounts and things like that. Won't you just share with the committee, because I think it will be extremely valuable for the committee to learn what is your experience as students of this system that is really costing the South African fiscus so much money, and which we would like to see as one of the flagship projects of the higher education term of our current minister. And yet it seems to us that there. What would you like to see different? It's being done differently, going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Who is the next member?
Honourable Killian. Thank you, sir. If there are no objections, I will appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, first of all, I haven't had the opportunity to have University of Stellenbosch here before. I actually want to congratulate them that they have made significant progress since we've last met and saw them. I am running a risk, because I have missed some of the questions. I am going to run a risk that I may pose a question that was already posed, but you will then just, or they will just ignore it. Check, first of all, it is good to see, because I think my sense is they are setting the right tone at the top. They're saying this is a new era, this is Son of Us going into the future, whatever the traditions, etc. They belong to the past. We have a rich heritage, but we're actually building a new one. And I think that is the message that I sense in what they present to us. So I think there's real commitment for a meaningful transformation. You know, not just painting over whatever was. So I really want to feel that is the sense that I get. However, I just wanted to understand with your practical implementation, and I think University of Free State also developed a multilingual plan. They rely very heavily on interpretation facilities. Have you not, perhaps, or will you in future, what is the need out there? Have you determined that? Is there a need for an additional language, especially in the sort of foundation phase or programs of university? Do you perhaps have such a need? You know, sometimes it is just that initial first year. Have you found that there's any way that language barriers may prevent progression of first-year students? And have you perhaps determined that need yet? Or are you working on it going forward? Secondly, what is your first-year pass rate? If you will tell us what it is, has it improved? Has it sort of stabilized? What is the position? And what are you doing to improve? And what is your throughput rate? And what are you doing to maintain or improve on that? And to what extent does language play a role there? Just, it would be very important for us to determine that, Chairperson. Chairperson, then, the several surveys have indicated, and polls or whatever, have indicated that and I think that is what you also said, that if students, especially in their first year, when Dr. Bladen Zimandi also said that, if they have housing on campus in the residences, they in fact improve the academic performance. What is the actually gap in student housing? What would you still like to achieve? We see your program, your infrastructure rollout, but what do you want to achieve as far as that is concerned? Just clarity, because this is part of your infrastructure rollout, is this hub, the hub idea. It could actually be a very interesting idea because of the need for social integration. What are your aims of developing that? Is it particularly also with that in mind? So then I would like to ask... The transformation plans as far as staff profile is concerned. You're telling us the same that we are finding from other universities, and that is that you have your students. I only noticed the department here. Could I? You have your students, and then very often at the end of a course, the financial need is so great that they must immediately find work. And to what extent do you determine which of those students which would actually prefer to go into an academic career but cannot afford it? Because if I look at your Rector Strategic Personnel Fund and your NGAP allocation, clearly if we only grow, as Honorable Mbasha has said, I think that's what I heard him say, own fresh timber, it is something, but it's not enough. So what would the need be that you would establish? And have you done any surveys or determined that? and would you tell us? Because you see, this is a very important program, and if you are having success by retaining academic staff for further development, masters, honors, masters, doctorate, etc., what can we do to roll out those programs over a broader sort of scenario? Chair, there was one other question that I noted. You have said that in 2016 you awarded a very large percentage of South African postgraduate qualifications to African colored and Indian students. Do you have any sort of quantifiable number that you can tell us? This is what you've had, this is what you have, and what is your target, you know, going forward? How would you like to achieve it? We know that they are being poached by other universities. We understand that. But you're also developing our academic, you know, profile of the country in doing so. Chair, I think I've covered everything. If there's anything, may I just come in at the end? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let me start by thanking all the presentations that were made. I will start by commending the university on the progress that they have made in terms of the transformation ever since we met the two meetings before. It is evident that there is work in progress. And also to commend them for the goals that they are setting for themselves, especially the one of maintaining the academic excellence, and also the effort that they are going to ensure that there is good stakeholder relations. My first question will be on the university, on the targets that they've made for the employment equity on the staff and students. And then I just want to check what are the plans that they are ensuring in the councils, that they also include the black Indians and the colored members in their and also women in their council. And then my other questions will be on in terms of the student housing policy. The student housing policy that is facilitating transformation, how does the university ensure that there is adequate monitoring to racial integration and social cohesion among students, because we often have some incidents in the residence? And the last one will be on the after the implementation of all these transformation policies, I just want to check how is the relationship between all the stakeholders? Are they fine with that one? And then I want to hear it from the SRC, whether they are satisfied in all the issues of transformation that are happening in the university. They must just tell us whether there is evident things are happening, there is transformation, really transformation. Because I was worried when you were saying something like you have to ask. I don't know whether it's in terms of the language of instruction in the lectures. You have to ask whether maybe the lecture can, I don't know, maybe you can just clarify that one. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the presentation. The first question, I would like to, the university was engaged in the process of developing a new admission policy during 2016. I would like to know whether this policy has been finalized and implemented in 2017 admission process, and just to share with us a few pointers, what does it entail, which is different from the previous one. Secondly, it has been reported by the university on its website that 10 members of Senate did not support the adoption of the language policy, and some council members walked out of the meeting after it was adopted. Again, one member resigned. If you can share with us what reasons were advanced by members who objected to a policy meant to promote broad access and success of students despite their race, and why did they want policies that entrench inequality? I have been covered by Honorable Mbatha. If you can share with us on the issue of the ever absent chairperson of the council to our meetings. Thank you so much. And Chair, I'm not happy with this part on language policy implementation survey, that the number of participants was 4,793, of which that is 24%, which is not really giving us a true picture on the reception and the acceptance of the new language policy. I would like to know from the university whether they are willing to do another one, which will give them, because high representativity, if there are many people who are responding to the survey, we get a better picture than having this 24%, which is really not giving us anything. Thanks.
Did I, Honorable Kikana?
Thank you, Chair. This question, I like it to be answered by students generally about the policy, which from the report, the policy transformation, language policy, and all these changes are very impressive. But that is yet at an idealistic level. Here, what is important, especially from the report that we've been getting from students in the past, was that things on the ground are different. So here the taste is of the pudding is in the eating. We like the student to respond if they didn't cover this during their report, maybe for my sake. I just want to know, are these policies, especially the language one, because in the past we are saying, yes, in policy, there is multilingual language, but in practice, this is what we got from students in the past, that in practice, lecturers use all kind of technical ways to actually not affect this policy. For example, they would come with translation, and when you go into a class, the translation system is not operative to an extent that this the lecturer resort to speaking to Africans only. And they thought it was a mechanism intentionally to use that technical thing so that the language policy is not implemented. So it is students that must actually tell us actually what is happening. The second point on gender, I also appreciate that you've got so many ladies participating at enrollment, at staff, and so on. But the other report that we got in the past was that students are sexually harassed to an extent that they are hearing whistles. And I thought it was just unimaginable that in a university, there's so much stress that students have to carry whistles like refereeing a football match, and when they attack, they've got to blow it. So are they still carrying whistles around especially in the evening when they go to studies or to the library. The last point, while transformation according to the report is good, the changes are good, again the question gets asked, because Stellenbosch was said to be number one in academic excellence in South Africa. Are you still holding that position? You see, it will be a sad day when you transform, when you bring about changes and standard drop, because it's going to give an impression, hey, these blacks, if you take them on board, you can be assured you'll drop standard. They are just the type of species that drop standards wherever they are. So we're interested to know whether you are able to bring changes, but at the same time retain your high standard, number one in the country. Thanks.
Honorable Bhutto.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Now, I'll just be brief. There's just one point I've just noted now, and I acknowledge the point made that a task team was formulated for the renewal of the particular curriculum due to the call of students. And I just want to perhaps ask, in terms of the representation within the task team itself, all stakeholders represented adequately? Because the challenge we face, I remember in SRC when we had the higher education summit, you found that there's a sudden rise of movements. Where the SRC is sidelined, we might be sitting negotiating adequately because we believe that these are the student representative council, but there's always certain agendas that are always crippled in. So I want to make sure that there's proper representation within those platforms and that we're able to engage adequately. And the second one is, in terms of the merits and bursaries that are awarded, do we take into account the circumstances of the students? You mentioned that in the admission policy, you acknowledge certain criteria. And I just want to check, in terms of funding, do we also take into that into account when we give bursaries? Because I might not necessarily have achieved 80%, but my 60s and 80% looking at the fact that I didn't have textbooks, I didn't have lights, etc. It's just those two points, Chairperson.
I'll just ask one or two things, but mindful of the fact that we have another presentation hereafter, and of course many questions were asked. I'll just have to see how we can manage that up to the hour, because we have the HSRC also who's going to make a presentation, which of course you are welcome to listen to because it's about yourself also. I want to check with you the following. Have you at all been able to learn the lessons from UCT? UCT experienced equally their own challenges, where students said that we are here, but we're not welcome. And what lessons are being learned from those expressions that has been made? It's really the precursor of very many things that started to happen. I equally want to encourage everyone that I don't think it's going to be helpful to say 24% is a high enough number. I think the aim is obviously what is it that we would like to achieve, because it's not a numbers game, this. It's a constitutional imperative. It's a legislative obligation. It's a Bill of Rights aspect. And how do we get to the expression of what the Constitution says, what the Bill of Rights says, and indeed why we had 1994 in this country? And so I think that I want to caution that we should be complacent with the 24%. But rather say what it is that we are working towards, because the stakeholders are important stakeholders, and who are they? It's both the management, the recipients. As recipients, the students are recipients too, but of course there are the large majority of people outside. So they might not all apply to come to you, but they are important stakeholders because they gauge what is going on in Stellenbosch from where they are. and sometimes they are influenced by whether they should send their children there or not. Those that still have young people that are coming to the university, we can't exclude them completely. I was a little bit concerned about the bond presentation that says they are too expensive. And it was referred to people from the disadvantaged group. I'd like to ask again, I mean, if the intention is that we have to bring people from different socioeconomic categories in society, what else are being done? It's almost close to the last block that said that they were too expensive. I felt a bit offended, I must be honest, about that. I trust the intention was not that, but I felt offended about it because the intention sounded good. But if the view of the university is that we've got to make sure that poor people can also come into the university, so of course poor people don't have money to pay for transport, they don't have money for accommodation, they don't have money for fees. So of course every university must make sure that the access must never be denied. I thought I must raise that that one. I'm keen to find out the swastika issue, of course, is not the greatest at all. Now, the university responded by what? You have probably suspended and you've done lots of investigation and so on. Is that the only solution to the students too? Is that the only solution? At some point, you had something called spread the love. What happened about that? Seems the love has not been spread wide enough. But the truth is, let's be honest about it. This is a process. It is not going to achieve everything tomorrow. But as we journey this process together, what are the different things to assist the process along, and what are those hard questions that needs to be asked? Because at the end of the day, we can say we will achieve so many women, and it's right, the majority of people in South Africa are women, so of course we must be biased towards that. And we will be able to achieve equity plans and all of that, and then what? Because I don't think it has to end there. I reiterate again, it's not just a numbers game. It's about what is the final product that we would want to achieve. And are you asking those hard questions? Because South Africa is a country that the Constitution says we are united in our diversity. And what does united in our diversity mean at Stellenbosch? And how are that being taken into consideration? And indeed, we have different cultures, all of us. We do still, in 2017, have a country where there's a bit of a birds of a feather flock together still. I don't think we can not say it's not true. It's true. It's still there. Now, you see, that you're not going to find in your equity plan. And then how are those kind of things being addressed, again, because of what you want to achieve finally and should have been achieved 20 years ago. We will be meeting with the Portfolio Committee on Police for another matter, but they have also asked to include police matters at universities, which is something that this committee wrote to them quite a while ago when there were problems at the university, and the committee have written to us now to say that they want to come and talk to us about that also. We would want to raise with them the fact that universities are inundated with matters that are outside of the purview of the university, which is really supposed to be a matter that must be taken up by other spheres. if there's anything that you would want to raise to us in that regard that we can put to that committee, I think it would be welcome. Lastly, I want to say that you asked us to write something for, where do we need to send the something to for the vigil that you're going to have? If you can inform us in your response. And to the students, maybe there's a bit more that you probably could have told us, because you really touched on, we understand fees is an important aspect, SBACs, NASFAS is important to you. We appreciate that. And, of course, the committee is engaging NASFAS all the time about it, because it's not only yourself, it's countrywide, that we must make sure that this new program. But we really wanted to hear from the students. You are the recipients of what the university presented here, and so you had a bit of a one line, and then you went to NASFAS. And I'm saying we appreciate the NASFAS story, but the one line, I am concerned that you only had one line, and I don't think that can be the case. I won't say you are intimidated by the management here. You don't look like you are intimidated, but why a one line? They not. But why a one line? I think it helped, because It helps us in understanding also the process that are being undertaken. Where is it heading to? And the people that come in by that gate, the majority of them are students, and so they have a lot to say about it. And your contribution helps the process to say exactly where it is. Now, I have said that the time limit that we have is a little bit, not a lot, but it was important to hear everyone, so I'm going to ask your assistance in the responses and see how we can do it, so mindful of the fact that we have another presentation that we need to receive.
So thank you very much, Chair. How much time do we have? Until 12 o'clock?
Let's see how we get to 12 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay, so that leaves us actually very little time, Chair. But I really I thank the response, the generally positive response of the committee members to our presentation, and appreciate clearly their interest and their commitment and their involvement and engagement with this very important process. So I need to beg the forgiveness of the committee members if a huge number of issues that were raised, as is rightly so. Not only pertaining to our institution, but it is certainly generalizable to the entire higher education sector, not only nationally, but also internationally. So we could spend many, many days talking about many of these issues. So please, if I do not address all of these issues, but I think I should try and group them into larger issues. I think I need to... and I'm going to ask some of my management team to also address them, Professor Koopman and also Professor Schoenwinkel. So, but I do need to start with the one issue, which is the absence of our chair. I do not want to suggest that I can speak on his behalf, but I certainly he would very much want to be here, but he's a very active businessman and executive, members of the boards of directors, and these meetings have been scheduled a long time in advance. And unfortunately, some of the meetings, the last two meetings in general that we've been asked to or requested to attend here, have been at relatively short notice. So some of these meetings have been scheduled long in advance. But I will certainly impart that to the chair. I'm going to ask Professor Schoenwinkel to address some of the issues surrounding language, specifically the survey and also future plans for a longitudinal nature in following up our student expectations and the issue of interpretation in class. Professor Schoenwinkel.
Thank you, Chairperson. The difference between a policy and the implementation, as Honourable Member Bazzoli and Honourable Member Mbata has mentioned, is indeed a challenge. The first survey we had was 2 months after we implemented the new policy. it is certainly going to be a lateral survey being done semesterly so that we can see how it's implemented. The other part that runs in parallel is the implementation in the faculties. And they have to, by the 17th of July, respond to us in the management as to how did it really go in the faculty based on student feedbacks which have been collected at the end of the semester. And then we will make adjustments. In fact, they have to report on how the faculties will adjust to the practicalities of implementation to improve for second semester, where we will again have an institutional-wide survey. So it is a learning process, and it is indeed a challenge for the implementation, but be assured that we will monitor and that we will try to adapt to make our teaching indeed accessible. Any other issues? Let me see that I may while I have the word.
The rate of students
passing, the dropout rate. Our dropout rate for the first years progressing to the second year is about 10%. And our average university module pass rate, that is, how many students pass compared to those who've enrolled, is now standing at 86%. And our final graduation rate varies. For the medicine program, obviously, it's almost 100%. For engineering, it's in the order of 75%. But institutionally, our graduation rate, completing with the minimum years plus two at the most, is above 75%. And that is really important, that when we actually invite a student, we put everything in place, financially, mentorship, tutorship, residence, to ensure that the student has the complete package so that we don't take on a student and actually leave them in a situation where they are worse off than before they came to tertiary studies. That was the past, right? The matter of interpretation, the real-time interpretation, let's admit it. The interpreter can never be as good as the lecturer herself. It is always an additional way of support. But we must take that into account with other measures of support, of which tutorials form a very important part, where we have tutors who actually are able to assist the students in the different languages on a one-to-one basis. Most of our lectures now are offered in all contents in English, with summaries in Afrikaans, and in the first year we offer interpretation. We found that by the second year, students feel more comfortable studying in an environment where all contents is at least offered in English, and thereby the demand for real-time interpretation drops strongly in the second year. But we believe in first year still serves a purpose. Student preference for language, we analyzed it by home language group, and there's certainly a strong shift from students with Afrikaans home language to now prefer their lectures in English. And that we believe we should accommodate without neglecting those students for whom Afrikaans is the best access to tertiary education as well. And that's the basis for multilingual offering. Involving students in the decolonization task team, the task team comprises students who've been nominated by the SRC and the Academic Affairs Council, students in the professional academic support staff, and faculty members who are making decolonization a field of study from the various faculties. And this report is expected in the month of June to be reported all the way up to council. But certainly students are part of the deliberations.
Area for first year.
Language is a barrier for first-year students. I tried to explain that indeed that is the challenge here, and that's why we have a lot of parallel meaning offering in the first year as well as teaching interpretation as well. The aims of the hubs, what could we do? We have seven clusters in which the residences and the private student organization are clustered together. At the moment, we have three hubs operational. The ideal is to have a cluster in every hub in every cluster, because that's where students actually learn to study together, support each other academically,
to socialize together. And I believe that is the way, if one cannot provide accommodation for every student, at least provide physical areas where students can interact. So the ideal is to have a hub in each. And there are about 30 million at current building cost per hub, and we've got three of them operational. If I miss something, please come back, but I try to cluster some of the questions together. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to deal with the Honourable Van Westhuizen's question regarding senior academics and also academic capacity growing our own timber. And I think those two are very tightly linked. So, yes, there are a number of policies, of measures that we're taking to really, as other institutions in the country, that we're taking to increase our staff diversity. But I think the aspect of growing our own timber is indeed is very important. So where we alluded to that last year we had a record of master's degrees, students is 1,486 with, and also PhDs 278, 47% of those were from the African, colored, and Indian groups. That is a significant number. 1,486 masters, 278 PhDs, and we now have increased our number of postdocs to 307. So really a very significant increase over the last number of years. So I see that in the cohort of those masters and PhD students that is the next generation of our academics. There is the unfortunate reality that an academic career is not a sprint. It is a marathon. So it takes some time. So that is why we're very excited about the NGAP program and the fact that we've been awarded more. We now have 11 positions. I'm actually on record that what we want to achieve also through the Rector Strategic Personnel Fund, that we want to do a 3-to-1 match from our own resources for any NGAP type position that we have. Unfortunately, some of the financial issues that came to the fore last year also with a decrease in subsidy and also student tuition pressures that it's caused us to look at that in some closer scrutiny. But I think the success that we've had with the Rector Strategic Personnel Fund of creating 33 new additional positions and also promotions for African, colored, and Indian staff, I think it's really made a significant contribution also in terms of the level of people that we were able to attract. Because what NGAP actually, and also from our efforts, allow us to do is exactly what was alluded to by the Honorable Mabata, that it allows one to identify those very talented honors, masters, young PhD students, and to give them the appropriate mentoring as they're going forward into either completing their PhDs, postdocs, sending them overseas or wherever for additional gaining expertise, and then bringing them back in a nurturing environment. So that's something that I'm very excited about. In terms of, just briefly, Chair, in terms of, what about the UCT lessons with regard to the future going forward? I think it's important to bear in mind that every institution has its own particular characteristics, and one should be careful of a one-fits-all approach. And I think, as I emphasized in my opening remarks, the most important thing we've learned is that adversarial relationships are lose-lose, and we should not embark on that road. And I think that's why we termed 2017 a year of engagement with all of our different stakeholders, and that's really been the important principle underlining that. I'm going to ask Professor Kupan to address some of the issues that were raised, and then perhaps Ms. Julies can follow on that.
Thank you, Chair. Very briefly, Chair and members of the committee, one remark on staff and then on institutional culture, the questions pertaining to institutional culture. The one on staff, we are really thankful for you really cautioning us to say don't replace one form of gender injustice with another one. So if you grow your female numbers and you sit targets take that into consideration. We're thankful for that. At the moment, the challenge for us is to say you have a significantly growing number of females participating in academic and other spheres of university life. And we also have the challenge that we must increase our number of females on senior academic levels and also on senior academic support staff levels and even management levels. So that is a challenge. Pertaining to institutional culture, I'm really, when Councillor Bata just said that it's free advice. I was thinking free.
His honourable member is very shocked to hear he's a councillor.
Sorry. Honourable member. Honourable member, when you said that, I was thinking about the thing of the most cherished. You often get free, and I thank you for that, because you gave us very good pointers regarding institutional culture. What I want to emphasize here is relating to institutional culture is that we're really at the stage now where we're implementing the policies and the plans that we had adopted. So this is the phase where we are, and you cautioned us to ask who benefit from your policies and your plans and be sensitive about that. And this relates also, Madam Chair, to your when you heard that they are too expensive, it's crucial for us really to say we have as foundational principle the principle of dignity of our country, to say namely that we must ask as an institution, when you measure your excellence, you must ask excellence for whom? And we really want to be an excellent institution for the most vulnerable. And therefore, it's not for us a burden to say we must be more inclusive, and we must try to include the most excluded and most marginalized young people of our society. So that is really the heart of the institution. And then the other thing is also, you were asking about the whole notion of what we do with this Nazi type of event at our institution, that besides the process of investigating, you have to proactively continue with your building of transformation competency and really proactively say this cannot be part of our institutional culture. Your question also on what if you meet all the targets, all the numbers quantitatively, you pose the challenge and we accept it, that we say qualitatively we must also transform, meaning we must really overcome as South Africans broader, but also as a university, overcome the subtle, even subconscious prejudices with which people still live, relating to race, relating to gender, relating to sexual orientation. So that challenge of yours to say work qualitatively as well is for us a crucial one and an encouragement that we also freshly accept today.
I want to suggest that we allow the students to answer. We are certainly not going to be able to get all the responses, and I would suggest those that are not answered, if you can write in detail to us on those answers. To the future leaders.
Thank you, Chair. We will keep it short. We have sort of split them amongst ourselves, but we will keep them very short. We aim to have 5 minutes max. So I will speak on the general context of Stellenbosch. Firstly, Stellenbosch is, as you all have known, is where the birth and of the apartheid system is sort of created. And Stellenbosch students is very aware of this, especially our BCI students. While we are aware of this, we have... Excuse me? Black-colored and Indian students? Apologies, honourable member. So we are very aware of this, and because we are aware of this, we have made it our student initiative and also our initiative to sort of change that culture. in terms of language, in terms of funding, in terms of all these other cases, we are aware that there is disadvantages to us. We are aware of this. But we have made it our mission not to sort of sit back and allow this to be a negative to us. So we are pushing through. I don't want to speak a bit more because the other members will speak more on the context. In terms of language policy, there is a, I won't say dissatisfaction, but there's a dissatisfaction on the SLC and the Academic Affairs Council of the percentage of students that have participated. So this is why we have launched the awareness campaign plan, where we will work together with the teaching and learning office to make sure that another sort of survey comes in towards the end of the semester, because this survey came out a month after classes started, which means it's fresh. So lecturers could have at the start been doing what they're supposed to, but we have heard through the grapevine some of them have sort of missed the plot along the way. So we are working together with them to sort of get that feedback again. In the classes itself, we have heard from academic affairs councils who have direct link to the faculties that they have not received formal sort of complaints. Formal complaints does not mean that there is no problems. So we are, again, working together with who are the class reps who are in the classes themselves to find what are the resources that they need to make sure that if there is issues that they can report it back to us so that we can then take them further. So we are trying to make sure that there is awareness, because what we see is that even the implementation plans of faculties, students are not much made aware of this. While some lecturers make them available, others do not. So this is a problem for us, and we are not happy about this, but we are working on making sure that when we go into the second semester, that students are well taken care of. Then I will just talk on the decolonizing curriculum task team. I will mention at the start of the task team, the students were not initially invited. Myself was the chair of the Academic Affairs Council, and curriculum is directly part of my mandate. We were not invited at the start. Only after inquiry, we were then invited. But students were included. However, we feel that more work can be done in terms of student representation and also feedback, because we see right now it is much more academic practice than getting on the ground knowledge and on-the-ground experiences from students. And in an institution of 30-plus thousand students, I think we should not think that two students or a working group of 30 students is enough to, for example, get the full feedback and full experiences of students. So then, yes, and that is all I have to say. Then Maxwell, just speak on my transmission.
Very quickly.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. In terms of transformation, I would say that from the SRC side, we are not satisfied per se as we are representing students, but we acknowledge the progress that has been made by the university. But what is quite something that we always address with the university is the language barrier, which is all within students, the staff within the university not being informed of like the policies, actually not taking account of the policies that has been made by the university. And also the residence culture, there's always residents. I mean, even yesterday we experienced some racial issues in another residence that we needed to address with a swift move. And also in terms of the transformation, I can say almost all stakeholders are actually involved. So students are actually involved in discussions, but in terms of implementation, the implementation is necessarily very, very slow, and that is the depressing side in terms of the transformation. But there is progress, and we do acknowledge there and when working with the university. Thank you.
Okay. While Liana is coming back, I will just respond on the gender question. No, we do not I just have to say, we know we do not wear the whistles anymore. I think I wore my whistle for one day and didn't work. But right now what is happening, there's about 15 WhatsApp groups with about 200 females in WhatsApp groups and online pages where if issues or anything arises, then it immediately is triggered in the groups and then it is spread to all the other groups. So, Liana, what do you think? Continue.
Dumelang. My name is Liana Letabo Mahesu. On the NASFAS, after a very productive meeting with DHT, the Western Cape SRCs decided to contact NASFAS. We called a meeting on the 23rd of May, of which we had demands. One was the extension of the labs, because we felt like it's impossible, especially for Stellenbosch, as we were going into exams. The second thing was communication, and it's still a problem. The third thing was decentralization, as there were numerous problems from other universities. I would not want to engage on that because it does not really affect us as much. In terms of Stellenbosch, we sent NASFAS two emails already requesting feedback or a way forward because they promised us that there will be an extension and they will communicate. So they have not communicated as yet, and today is the 31st, and that means if we don't get communications, our students will be excluded currently. In Xbox as well, they mentioned that they will communicate in this regard. We had our bursary officers there and different university SRCs of which we raised concerns. I'm aware that DHT is having a meeting today with NASFAS, I think. Email like that was sent. Hopefully they will give us feedback after the meeting, so we will communicate with them. For the vigil, please email sr@sun.ac.za. And then, what else? Yeah.
All right. Okay. I have to ask to end there. Again, I invite those questions that have not been asked, that have not been answered, honorable members, that everyone put that in writing to us. We're sorry to stop you, but again, we extend a welcome to yourself to sit with the next one, although I think you did say you wanted to leave, but if you do have time, you still may sit in on the next presentation. Was there anything, Rector?
Chair, just in conclusion, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'd just like to respond to, in conclusion, to the Honourable Pekana's remark and with regard to the excellence and quality conundrum. I must say that is one issue that gets me really hot under the collar when people start asserting that our excellence will suffer if we increase our diversity and increase the types of students that we have at our institutions, because I think that's exactly why we will be excellent, is because we do that and achieve that through diversity and the richness of what we have to offer. Often when I speak to alumni events, and some of them, they're now in some of the younger and the older groups, and the older groups don't tend to believe me always, but I can honestly say I finished as a medical graduate at Stellenbosch University in 1983, when it was very much a one population group university, and when I left in 1990 as a specialist, and when I returned in 2013, the medical school, fully diversified, is a much better medical school than what it was, and Stellenbosch University now is a much better university than when I was there. So I'm very pleased with what is happening. So thank you, Honorable Pekana.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. As I said, you're welcome to stay, but of course if you can't, you may take leave of the meeting, and we're going to go to our last presentation. May I profusely apologize to the HSRC, but I trust you have benefited from the presentation of Stellenbosch also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Honourable members, may I ask you to take your seats? Can I ask the HSRC to do their presentation?
Morning. May we receive the presentation from the honourable members? Can you take your seats? May we ask Stellenbosch to leave? Over to yourself.
Okay. Honourable members, Madam Chairperson, and to the DS officials, Dr. Fishi and Dr. Narsi, thank you very much for this opportunity to present the research of the Labour Market Intelligence Partnership to you.
My name is Vijay Reddy, and I'm an executive director at the Human Sciences Research Council, and I'm the lead research project. And maybe as a way of introduction to say, I think there's nothing more pleasing for a researcher than to present their findings, to present their work, especially to people, well, in the country, you form the group of the highest policy influencers. And so it's indeed a privilege for us to share this research. I'm going to introduce the team in a minute, and I'm going to do that through the research part itself. Now, as you probably know, this research was commissioned and by the Department of Higher Education and Training, and it had to deal with the issue of how do we plan for skills in the country. And while we had done some skills projections, it wasn't a very exact science. And so the idea of commissioning the HSRC-led consortium, and again I'll give you more details, to work on this research, was to develop a body of evidence that would give DHET the kinds of tools in order to form the skills planning mechanism. And so the question is, why skills planning? Why should any country undertake this task of skills planning? And I'm glad we don't have to spend much time to convince you of the need for skills planning, as we have the National Development Plan, and we used to have we have within the DPME one dimension is planning. But in terms of skills itself, one could approach it in very different ways. You know, the government has to be able to estimate what are the skills needs down the line. We need to see what kind of skills are needed to grow our economy, what kind of skills is needed to for our society. And the general approach is either we could go through this process by waiting for market failure and then respond to it, or we could anticipate the needs, the skills needs in the country. The decision has been taken that for the country that we anticipate and therefore estimate our skills needs and involved in this planning process. The 2009 administration had articulated within its performance outcomes, outcome 5.1.1, which was to establish a credible institutional mechanism for skills planning. And that, it has other dimensions to it, there's three dimensions to it, but the dimension to develop the evidence-based was asked of the HSRC and the research consortium. And this work started in 2012. It was a four-year research project, and we're coming to the end of it. It's 4 years. We've accumulated a great deal of research reports, evidence. We would have liked to share all of it with you, but we have a wonderful website, lmip.org.za. And so the research reports are there if you want to dig deeper into it. I'm also sorry, the original invitation, we had planned for a 2.5-hour presentation, and then I think yesterday or the day before it was reduced to 1 hour, and so anyway, good South Africans, we will make a plan, but we'll give the presentation, and what we want to do in the presentation is just to give you tasters of the research. And so, and you, of course, will be digging deeper into this. And just to say again that in skills planning, we had to determine what is it, what kind of evidence that we needed, and what kind of ways of approaching it. And for this, we needed to sort of understand the signals of the quality and the quantity of the skills that will be needed by our economy, the trade in investment policies, both immediately and in the future. So our key purpose was then to look for what kind of information and what kind of research intelligence. We defined this project as a labor market intelligence partnership, and we divided it into six themes of work. And the first theme of work was establishing the foundation for the labor market
systems, what kind of information, what kind of data that we needed in order to make decisions. I led that team of work, and also somebody that's going to present relating to this team of work is Bongiwe Mwango, and maybe Bongiwe can just wave and say hi there. The second theme of work was undertaken by WITS University, and it was a skills forecasting for supply and demand, and we're not presenting that now. It was a different project that the DHET had commissioned WITS University. The third theme of work relates to studies of selected priority sectors and to understand the link between sectoral growth and the economy and skills itself. And Professor Harun Bore from UCT led that theme of work. Yeah. The fourth theme of work relates to reconfiguring the post-school sector and looked at the interaction between and alignment between the different types of training systems and the labor market. And Dr. Glenda Cruz from the HSRC led that theme of work, and also Dr. Michael Gastro worked in that theme. So Michael's there. Our fifth theme of work is relates to the pathways through education and training into the workplace. And here we undertook largely tracer studies and to look at the progression studies through the post-school education, post-school in sector and the labor market. And Dr. Michael Rogan from Rhodes University led that theme of work. And be interesting sort of linking up to the questions you've raised in Stellenbosch at universities itself, because it's producing some of that result. And the last theme of work is understanding the changing artisanal occupational milieus and identities, It's about looking at artisanal skills and how this changes the occupational structures and the knowledge bases. And Dr. Angelique Wolfskut from the HSRC led that theme of work. In addition to the theme leaders that are here, there were a range of other researchers, but we thought we'd have this as a theme. And for each of these, we'll just present a little taster of work. And a little taster. We have a particular presentation, and because of time changes, we're going to actually, rather than my starting off, we're going to start off with Professor Borat, because he has a meeting. But I think it's important for him to give the indication of his research work. So excuse me while I get to the right part of it. Yeah, yes. And within the PowerPoint presentation, we were so excited about the long presentation, so I think, Anela, you sent all of it there, plus yesterday some sort of consolidated picture or a shortened picture, and Harun will lead with the economic growth and skills planning. Do you want to use that?
Oh, okay. Let's switch. Thank you very much. Vijay and Chair, and I'm always happy to be in Parliament. The last time I was here, I was talking about the national minimum wage, so I'm very happy to be here, not to be discussing something too controversial. But in essence, as Vijay said, I was the, or at least our institution, the Development Policy Research Unit at UCT, was the, if you like, the theme three guardians, but also the economists on the team. So in many senses, we tried to provide the economic lens in many of the areas and the thematic foci that you saw earlier. So as Vijay indicated, what I'll try and really give you is a very small snippet of the type of work we did, and to some extent perhaps I've tried to give you sort of the first principles of how we would think about skills development, about the nature of demand for skills or occupations in the first instance. There are a whole series of other papers that are fairly detailed, some that look at temporary employment services sector. There are others that involve a labor market survey of CETAs and so on. So those are, at your leisure, you can consult those on the website. So how do we start thinking? And perhaps this is where the debate can begin, and then my colleagues will no doubt add much, much more than I will. Is that for an economist, the way one wants to think about employment shifts and therefore skills demand is really about the structure of economic growth. Because ultimately, and as usual, being a reductionist economist, we think of the demand for labor, we think of employment as a derived demand for labor. So in other words, it's dependent on the structure of growth. In a very simple way, if an economy is only made up of two sectors, and those two sectors only need highly skilled machinists, well, then the structure of growth will define the skills profile that an economy has. And so one of the really important questions we had to ask within the project is, what does the structure of growth look like in South Africa? And so, and apologies, Chair, there's going to be lots of graphs and tables, but that's how economists hide their ignorance, right? So the first thing you would have noticed is that this is completely the wrong title, and that's my fault because it snuck in from another another presentation. It's not the population growth. This is a really instructive graph about the changing structure of South Africa's growth pattern at a sectoral level. So it's essentially the share of GDP in 1993, so I'm trying to find my cursor, on the left-hand side, as against close to the present day, 2012, share of GDP. There are a couple of really, really important things that are going on. The first, right, is that if you look at agriculture and mining, right, so that's sort of on the top part of the pie graph, you'll see that what we've witnessed is a significant reduction in the share of mining in total GDP. So effectively, another way to think about this is that mining share of GDP has declined dramatically in the South African economy since 94, and it's gone from 11% to 6%. The instructive question for this committee would be, well, if it's contracting, and we assume that's a linear going forward, that that's going to be, at best, what we'll have is a stabilization of mining, and it stays at 6%, what does it mean for skills development? What does it mean for the faculties of engineering and mining and so on? I'm being very blunt, and very almost too deliberate, but you get the meaning. So in a broad sense, you want to keep in mind how the economy's structure is changing. The thing that worries us as economists, because any economy moving from low-income country status through to middle and high-income country status, is that the lifeblood of any economy, if you think of South Korea, you think of Singapore, you think of Japan in the 50s, the lifeblood of those economies as they moved to high-income country status was manufacturing. And what has happened in South Africa, unlike a Vietnam or unlike, obviously, a South Korea, is that manufacturing has flatlined. So manufacturing share of GDP has declined, but essentially stayed the same from 19% to 17%. And in essence, that's a big concern. That's a big concern for growth trajectory that we need to be on, right? We need to be no economy in modern economic history from Great Britain onwards has managed to move to high-income country status or advanced industrialized status, and you'll keep me on time, because I can go on forever, without manufacturing it as front and center of its development trajectory. And we don't have that. So we've almost culled out our manufacturing sector, and there are all sorts of reasons for that, in pursuit of a growth trajectory that is essentially now services-based. So de facto, South Africa is now a services-based economy, and there are all sorts of statistics, employment, exports, and, of course, GDP. And so what you'll see is a contraction in agriculture and mining, the primary sectors, a flatlining of manufacturing, and so where's all the growth happened? Well, look at finance. So financial and business services has gone up, as has transport, and that includes communication and other sorts of services, have gone into that gap, if you like, and increased their share of GDP. And so, in essence, we've moved from being a sort of, if you like, agriculture and manufacturing-based economy to one dominated by financial and business services, wholesale and retail trade, and all sorts of other services. In general, and this is the key point for this committee, those services tend to be more high-tech, less employment-intensive, and often more skills-intensive. And so there's other research we've done earlier about the fact that South Africa's on a skills bias labor demand trajectory. So in essence, we are skills biased economy, and that feeds off the structure, the changing structure of our growth trajectory. This is a reminder, right, that with growth comes employment. So in essence, if you want to make linkages from economic growth through to skills demand, if you like, the bridge is employment, right? So in essence, what you want to do is understand how the nature of the growth trajectory will create employment, but the question is what types of employment, and we'll come to that later. But what you see here is really important, Chair, because if you recall from your standard 10 grade 12 mathematics, that's the 45 degree line, so if you remember that vaguely, you want to be, that's employment, right, and that's output value added, right, output on this axis here, the horizontal axis. If you're above the 45 degree line over there, right, that would suggest that you are on an employment intensive growth path, right? And what's very, very clear is that we're not in any sector. In any sector of the economy, we are not labor intensive, right? The ones that worry us, and I'll come back to it time and time again, is manufacturing. So manufacturing seems to be growing, but not really creating employment. On the bottom of the graph, you'll see that mining has both contracted and lost jobs. Agriculture, and this is where I get into trouble with the National Minimum Wage crew, agriculture's grown, but in that period lost jobs, and that's mainly because of the minimum wage. That's what our research shows. So in essence, there are dynamics within sectors that are really important to keep in mind, and those dynamics can have particular skilled outcomes. Let's not forget that as we grow, and as you pursue a particular structure of growth, the labor market needs to respond. So you need to find a mechanism through which growth will keep up with changes in the labor force, changes in the numbers of new entrants into the labor market in search of jobs. And so the question is, have we done that? And the answer, as we all know, is a resounding no. And so if I could take you perhaps to the third last column, right? What you have here is a percentage change in employment. So employment's gone up. Well, maybe let's look at the absolute numbers. We've created 6 million jobs since 1995. Let's look at it that way, right? Forget the bottom half of the table. We've created 6 million jobs, right? But over that same period, if I can find my cursor again, that's the number of people that have entered the labor market in search of work, 10 million. The math is simple. So you've had 10 million people entering the labor market cumulatively since 94 in search of employment, and our structure of growth, that those previous two graphs, have only been able to generate jobs for 6 million of those people. Hence, you end up, right, with the 4 million unemployed that you've got. Now, remember, that's an underestimate because I haven't included those. That's the broad definition, so it will include those who have given up looking for work as well. But in essence, what you have is an economy that's on a growth path that is not sufficiently labor-intensive. Think of that 45-degree line. We all need to be above that 45-degree line so you can mop up all those work seekers. And you ask the question, which I won't get into, where? Well, it's manufacturing. Manufacturing must be front and center. I haven't seen any economy, nobody's seen any economy in the modern period that's been able to generate large numbers of jobs without manufacturing. The chairperson's old history in the clothing industry and so on will know that that's low-wage jobs in light manufacturing is how you move up the development path, but also how you create employment for these large numbers of work seekers. So in essence, we haven't been able to create employment. This is a simple ratio of employment to GDP. I won't dwell on it, but effectively crystallizes the notion that the changing structure of the economy, even at absolute low levels of growth, so even if growth is low, if the structure's wrong, you're still going to be in trouble. You can get away with low growth if your structure's labor-absorbing. At least you're creating jobs for people, and we're not doing that. But in essence, there's a dual problem. There's a declining manufacturing sector, right, counterposed by a rising demand for skilled labor because of financial services. And stuck into that wedge is the rising number of under skilled, if you like, work seekers. And that's the conundrum we're in. And I think I'm almost there for the remaining presenters who are also going to run out of time. It's two more slides. What I try and do here, Chair, is really important. Is I'm interested in which sectors are creating jobs, because that 45-degree line gives me a bubble, gives me a broad sense, but I really want to see in a relative context which sectors are creating jobs. Now, I want you to cast your eye down. The gray ones collapse the green ones. So agriculture and mining are primary, manufacturing, utilities, construction are secondary, and so on, right? But look at what's happened in the primary sectors. Agriculture and mining collectively have shed 720,000 jobs since 2001, not even since 94, right? So you've got a massive contraction. And remember, if you're looking for vulnerable workers, you'll find them in agriculture. So a massive amount of jobs lost there. The secondary sector, that's the heartbeat. That's where manufacturing is supposed to be generating jobs, right? Since 2001, that's more than a decade. Look at that number for manufacturing, 112,000 jobs. Let me put it a different way. That's about 10,000 jobs a year. That's incomprehensibly low, right? It's insufficient for dynamic manufacturing sector. Where are the jobs coming from? Well, the tertiary sector. And the majority of them are coming from the public sector. Other research we show indicates that we've got a public sector that's growing too fast in employment terms, because it can never be a totally productive sector, right? Because it's not linked to direct production in that sense. That's what the international literature shows. But a lot of it is in financial and business services, transport, and wholesale and retail. And so in this growth trajectory where the employee or those on social grants immediately convert themselves into consumers, and marginal propensities to consume are very high, and so we're on this consumption-based economy rather than an investment-driven economy, in simple terms. But in essence, the last column shows you that about 70% of all jobs come from the tertiary sector. When one is thinking about the skills profile of this economy, you'll see very clearly, right, in very simple terms, one of the papers we did shows that in the last column that most of the skills-biased labor demand trajectory we see is because of technological change. And there are all sorts of things that are going on there. There is the fourth industrial revolution, but there's also the pressure on wages. There's also the pressure on employers looking for ways in which to cope with higher wages and therefore are making switches. There's no two ways about it. That's what employers are doing, and you see it in the data in terms of growing capital intensity. So last slide, Chair. What we've got basically in a little bit of the research we've shown is the structural mismatch. So you've got this case where you've got a labor demand trajectory drawn from a growth structure which is highly skilled, financial and business services driven. There's a little bit of wholesale and retail, yes, which is semi-skilled. But in essence, you've got this, I don't want to put it that way, but a runaway growth train that's demanding highly skilled workers. But on the other hand, the supply side, the supply of labor is effectively workers who are disproportionately, and we'll talk later about it, young workers with incomplete secondary schooling or matric. And that's insufficient. So you've got this mismatch. And unless you rejig your growth trajectory, and the easy win or the clear win is manufacturing, so you generate large numbers of low-wage jobs, you're going to always be playing catch-up, right? And it's that kind of challenge that I think lies at the heart of how one thinks of a more labor-intensive growth trajectory that at least allows the supply side of labor to catch up. Okay, Chair. Done, and with due apologies, I have to go and see PhD students, so it's a good excuse, who I've delayed since this morning because we were supposed to be earlier. If I could be excused within 5 minutes, if that's okay, Chair.
Except who's going to answer the questions that you, because you told half of the story.
Do you want to 5 minutes, and otherwise we'll also send you questions for
that, honourable members. Let's ask the questions to him. All the hands are up. I start here. Sorry.
Just before you go, just help me with this one of the fourth revolution, because I know of one revolution, the industrial one. Now, the first out imagines the technological one. And what is the second and the third? Because this revolution just come and it always catch, they always catch me napping. So please explain the second and the third revolution. Secondly, this thing of manufacturing, it was identified in our second review of the economic policy as GISA and GIPSA. While they spoke about skills there, at the same time said we must, in order to expand the economy, do manufacturing. Why can't we do manufacturing? Because they said, look, you've got all the raw material, agriculture. Platinum, we are number one producer in the world, and a lot of other minerals. And agriculture, yes, we still tend to do well in agriculture, and textile industry can flourish. And they said we should build infrastructure, and Soccer World Cup has assisted us build our infrastructure, airports, roads, and so on. But why can't they, if the infrastructure and electricity is now there, why can't we, because we're trying to push for skills. Artisans, they said you must produce artisans. Why can't we drive this economy the way we know we can drive it to flourish? That is my question.
Thank you, Chairperson.
I just want to maybe get something from you. Now that our country is in this junk status, and we are having mining and agriculture there as our primary thing, and to come out of that, I think we are agreeing that manufacturing is the something that can boost the economy. And then in terms of the skills, how can we do it to make sure that we come in this manufacturing more than agriculture and mining?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, this is absolutely fascinating, and I'm really very very sad that we cannot engage with this, because this is really at the core of issues, and as a committee, this is what we should be busy with. But be that as it may, if we look at South Africa within a global context, we find ourselves in a sort of a group of loosely called middle-income countries. Is there any country with a similar structural mismatch? And which are the countries? You have already referred to Singapore and those. What is the reason for our complete collapse as far as manufacturing is concerned? I suppose I can get you talking about that for 2 days. But the point is, what do we need to press to change this thing around? Because what we're seeing is a growing divide. Because those who don't make it into the tertiary sector will just fall away. There's no income, and there's no dignity, there's nothing for them. So obviously, we have to fix this problem right in the bud. It's a problem because it's come over some time. Is there any significant intervention that was the cause of this? And what is the national growth bar doing? Has this, the industrial policies, etc., is it on par, or does that need adjustment? Thank you.
Thank you, Shepherd. And one quick question from me. With all the universities and the TVET colleges, as well as private colleges and so on, why do we have this structural mismatch, and how do we correct that?
thanks for that. So I just wanted to know from the point of view of this committee, which is all about skills and education and training, to what extent can you have a skills-led development path? In other words, an education-led development path rather than a growth-led development path. And do we then advocate that we, as a committee, recommend to the department that it emphasizes the production of more skills for the kinds of areas that we want to grow in than technically we need at the moment, and that we do that as an investment into the possibility that growth will occur? I'm not saying it will cause growth, but certainly if growth does occur, you need the skills to be ready. So can skills development be in advance of growth, and should it be? Thank you.
Chair, I would like to know, what is the relationship between what we've seen and the fact that our schools are deemed to be dysfunctional, many of our schools, and that even our TVET colleges are not producing the numbers or the quality they would like to see? And is that because this, as my colleague has said, this committee, we can't influence macroeconomics, but we can perhaps influence the supply side. And if you could just comment on that, please.
So, of course, those are many questions. My only criticism is you telling us the end result of something. I'm not going to ask you to go through the result and why we have what we have now, but it is important to reflect on that part, because in order to create towards what, if you have mismatch is not because of pop-up. Mismatch is because of, since colonialism and apartheid and all of that, it's not a pop-up thing right now. I would ask, maybe if it is in the presentation, then that's fine. But I think it would be able to, because if you want to find a solution, you've got to know where it has come from. And then I think probably what would help also is the stubbornness of many problems that we're still sitting with. And therefore, do we really think a solution is just a one-path thing? And the fundamentals that we have put in place, are those fundamentals in terms of this sector, which is higher education and training, is that on course to deal with some of the things? I accept that the other colleagues will add a little bit more to, and that you're not going to answer everything, so don't feel pressurized. But let's try.
Thank you, Chair. So for all the honourable members, I'll say all protocol observed. So I don't need to. I've learned this from listening all to these speeches. That's an excellent question. The fourth industrial revolution. What are the first? What are the second and the third? My colleagues can help, but I know that the third was the microelectronics revolution. So that's the second. That's the onset of computers and so on. I'm not sure if there's a third, which was the information age, which was the internet and the digital revolution, which was moves us from computers to internet. And of course the fourth is the robotics. A really important part of how we think about the future, because it does, and maybe I'll sort of collectively try and answer some of the questions because they overlap a lot, is that if you think, and as we should, that the fourth industrial revolution is relevant, although sometimes overstated, remember that what it does mean, and it's shown in the data and other work that we've done, is that if you look at the per unit of jobs created for manufacturing in the Industrial Revolution, say from the UK, the number of jobs created there was far greater than the number of jobs created by currently being created by China for unit of output, and therefore the next industrializers will get fewer per unit jobs from manufacturing output. So in other words, in a simple way, what it means is manufacturing is becoming more and more capital intensive, so you have to also recognize that it's important, but you're going to get less bang for your buck in terms of jobs created. And that's another challenge, right? But perhaps the route wherein one thinks about placing skills front and center, I wouldn't say that one can replicate. If you put skills ahead of growth, there is a danger, although I think it's a minor danger in our context, of an overproduction of skilled workers. But I think if one tries to cleverly twin a skills development strategy to an economic growth trajectory, then I think there's something interesting. So in that context, for example, why do we see what we see with manufacturing? Well, it's because we've ignored manufacturing for too long in the first instance. In the second instance, when we've looked at manufacturing, and I always joke that my Toyota is going to be taken from me, is that if you look at IPAP's, the jewel in IPAP's crown is the motor industry. That's what it does, right? And this is not, I'm not being an advocate for removing the subsidies and so on, but 2 billion rand for example, of an IPAP subsidy creates 1,000 jobs. 2 billion rand. So in essence, you've got a very capital-intensive, large subsidy program that dominates our industrial policy landscape. Why aren't we looking at light manufacturing? Right? And that's part of the reason, the historical reason, Chair, is that we've experimented with these. It's a South African phenomenon, right? Large projects, capital-intensive, that dominates rather than smaller, more nimble sort of light manufacturing initiatives. And there are a whole range of those possibilities that we can explore. And so in that sense, if one had an engagement through this committee with IPAP, with the DGI officials, to say, well, where's your light manufacturing strategy that twins skills, that twins industrial incentives to skills production to employment creation? And we want to see the numbers to know that this is an employment-intensive industrial program. Because at the moment, I don't think it is, or at least we need to ask harder questions about that. In our own context, just as completely as an aside, the water shortage in Cape Town, desalination has been seen as a solution. Desalination is a huge project. It's capital intensive. Whereas if we go for groundwater, which is much smaller, you need lots of boreholes, it's lighter, right? But more employment intensive, that's not on the table. So it's a psyche that we have to constantly work against. And it's very unlike other middle-income countries. So if you look at in India, you look at in Malaysia, you look at in Brazil, the notion that you can develop, the notion that you can create employment through small businesses, through labor-intensive manufacturing, is far more embedded in how they think about development relative to us. A simple example is that if you look at the informal sector, right, on the skill side you can do stuff, right? But if the informal sector is not allowed to operate in cities, right, because of our growth and development trajectory, there's no way in which you're actually going to develop in a labor-intensive way. One last thing is on the higher education side, I think that's right if you give a signal to the higher education system to produce more skills, but be careful that you keep an eye on what types of skills. Botswana is sitting with the problem at the moment is that they've made a massive fiscal outlay for higher education, but 70 to 80%, we've just done some work with the World Bank, 70 to 80% of those individuals in higher education are in the humanities. It's the wrong type of skills. And so I think you can recalibrate the TVET system, you can re-look at the schooling system, but the trick is not in the numbers, the trick is in what people are studying. And I think often those kinds of build a new university, but then if 80% of the enrollees are in the humanities, you've done nothing in terms of the skills bias trajectory that we're on. My boss is stopping me, Chair, I have to go.
Chairperson, if I may be bold enough, as Haroon is right up the hill somewhere here, you can pop in more often.
Happy to come back, Chair.
No, I want to suggest that we must do justice with your presentation. So, honourable members, and I know that, you know, when the clock strike 1 o'clock, you're going to start disappearing also. And what I wanted to suggest is I don't want you not to present anything. I want to suggest that maybe what we should do is take part of the take your presentations the engagement is not going to be possible. And I want to persuade honorable members, this is a very important report. It's not something that you just give run and thank you very much, they were here. We think we must allow you to come back again, so that I think the other important part, so to allow the members to have a proper engagement also on this, because we are busy doing the Strathclan and APPs of the CETAs, and this helps us very much. So we want to see how we can do that. But let's try now and see how we do. But if you agree, honourable members, also, then I think we should do that. Honourable Kekana?
Yes, I agree with you, but I also want to request them, when they come, they mustn't come and talk and say we left with 5 minutes. They are PhD students. It's very important that we entitled, because this is ultimately going to decide on the policy of this country. One policy that is based on research, that is scientific.
Don't motivate.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, I would want to ask further questions, but maybe we should release them, let them come back, because and make more time to talk to us.
Can I please come to Professor Borat's defense? I just wanted to say we shunt them around, and we must accept that. So please, I would like to suggest, Chairperson, that we really need an entire meeting just dedicated to this, because this is absolutely critical. You see, Honorable Pazoli said, can you do skills planning? But, I mean, obviously, you cannot do that in isolation of seeing what is happening in the economy, seeing that we have vast unemployment, etc. So we must know where is the problem. And I've always argued,
motivate.
No, I've always
Thank
argued,
you.
Chairperson, that
no,
we should
no,
belong
no.
in the economic cluster,
no,
not in
no,
the
no,
social
no,
cluster.
No, 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 this is not for them. Where we should be. I accept that I don't want to send you away. Now you've come from all over, and I want to persuade the members to still listen to you for the next 15 minutes. 1-5. Yeah, I want to persuade the members, because thank you. I see all their thumbs are up, so they're keen. Let's not waste any more time. Let's get into it.
Well, we'll try to do part of the presentation, and maybe those that are not from the Cape Town base at the moment that have flown in here, and we'll try to do this. Yes, so we've had our rock star, and let us the lesser mortals come in and with the other presentations. Now, we will go around there a little bit, but I think this slide gives us the context and the way we need to look at skills planning for South Africa. There are different models in different countries, whether it's growth bias, skills bias, and very different ways of looking at it. But the analysis of the South African society and the economy just lays bare all the paradoxes, all the conundrums, all the nuances, all the complexities. And in terms of trying to produce and provide some sort of model, we've actually gone at it at a different way than the typical OECD or British or Australian models, which were more clinical. And we needed to do that. And in our defense, Prof. Pazoli, Honorable Member Pazoli, sorry, I've forgotten which one. we didn't dichotomize whether skills biased or skills led or growth led, because if you look at the overall education and skills levels of the country, they're so low. So you can't go wrong. It's a fail-safe policy to invest in skills and education, and so that's just part of it. But as I said, the important thing is just to remember the sense of the conundrums, etc. Again, to go very quickly on this, and we'll give you reading matter. As we approach the thinking about skills planning for South Africa, and as good researchers, we looked at other models and the way other countries approached it and tried to develop our model for skills planning.
We could have gone the market-based approach that the UK and Canada and other countries, where you wait for market failure and then respond to it. The other approach that is quite popular is the employer or social partner base, and that's countries like Germany, where the levels of education are high, the levels of unemployment are not as high as ours, and where there's the and in those countries, it's the analysis of the vacancies, and then so a sector is growing and you have a large number of vacancies, and so those analysis of vacancies then inform the education, the skills policy. Then we looked at some of the models in the Asian countries where the state intervention approaches are used, that in those countries the state analyzes the demand for skills, analyzes the economy and the demand for skills, and then informs the education and training policies. So there's a strong interventionist approach. I think similarly, South Africa, it is an interventionist approach. One needs the active labor market strategies, skills strategies, etc., in terms of our historical, in terms of our history. And in our case, we've said that if we're looking at this focus of it, that it is about, we look at both supply and demand. So, you know, the kind of thing that you talked about, because both are very important. And we also looked at the nature and trajectory of the economy and the society. In skills planning, we cannot exclude those 8 million people that are unemployed. And so that becomes very much part of our equation, and so the economy and vulnerable groups. Equally, in terms of analyzing it wasn't only analyzing the economy, but also the various state interventions, the strategic integrated projects, for example, there are a number of state and government interventions, and each of those interventions needs a set of skills in order to make it successful. So that forms part of our demand, whereas in other cases, it's just the private sector economy. If you look at where's the responsibility for skills planning, and again, it comes back to should the responsibility for skills planning be in one of the economic departments? Should it be Department of Labor or EDD or Department of Planning, or should it be DHET? We analyzed this and thought at this point we think DHET, with its link to education and training and informing the skills policy, is where it should be the driver for the skills planning unit. And for each of these slides we have a whole report. Now, as I said, for skills planning, we needed information and data. And important here is the information about the economy, and Haroon's given us some signals there. The analysis of the labor force itself, and we have information around the skills base, the age, the demographics, etc. We look at skills demand, and he referred to that, the skills supply and the institution, what the production from higher education, TVET, etc. And then it comes to what are this, what the literature talks about skill mismatches or skills imbalances. And you've referred to some of the mismatches as well. So that was key for our analysis and how that then informs the skills policy. Just because it's such a pretty slide and it's 1 o'clock, it's nice to get your attention, that we think that the data and information that we're looking at is supply, current demand, replacement demand, and future demand. And for each of those, we've indicated the kinds of data that is needed. Now, again, a good skills planning mechanism needs good data and information. We can only work with the kinds of data that we have, and so in building up this mechanism, we equally have to build up our data and information services. And we draw data from the HEMIS and the HEMIS data from DHET. We draw data from the Stats SA and the labor force surveys. And those, they're improving. We do wage analysis, et cetera. And the part that is not presented here is where they're trying to develop a forecasting tool for this. And skills planning, I think we would see it as not just about, it involves both a process as well as a structure. It involves actually the whole of society and the whole of government. And it can't be done in isolation. It's not just DHET's responsibility. And so we've categorized three levels, and the first is at national. It's dependent on the national development and what's going on nationally. It's about skills development at the national level, and then what's happening in terms of skills demand in firms at institutional level and in education and training institutions, and we have to get a synergy around that. At the national level, we need to be, skills planning will be led by Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation and Cabinet and how it sees growth and development in the country, and right now the NDP forms that. The demand-led departments, the DTI, EDD, DST, Treasury, and Business and Labor equally feed into what will be the macro-level economic plans. And so this information then feeds into DHET in order for them to develop the post-school education and training plan. And at the sort of ground level, we have firms, because that's where firms or institutions where labor practices happen, and education and training providers, universities, colleges. And so that there you will look at the enrollment and training plans. The firms with the education and training providers spell out through the CETAs, and you have the sector plans. And so we see this whole process as a coherent, coordinated process that takes the different levels of government or different levels of development, national, at a macro, meso, and micro level. So the other thing about skills planning, it does require a strong notion of joined-up government, because the economic departments and the education and training has to be talking quick. We did a lot of work, and I just want to use a little advertorial for our... Can I just have this for a minute? We produced this, and much of Haroon's presentation is in Chapter 1 on the economy here, on skills supply and demand in South Africa. And again, I want to reiterate that we took a different kind of approach, and that is one that's relevant for South Africa. When we thought about our, we can do the 160 pages, but we thought it's nice to have, this is for plain reading, and your quick coffee shop, it's smaller. Once you read that, then dip into this. But these two documents are linked up on there. And again, I'm going to go, the economy and demand for skill is what we refer to, the education and skill supply. And all that you've said, the schooling system produces very few graduates that can go successfully into higher education and vocational education. And the document provides the analysis of output for skills. And equally, I think somebody, Haroon responded in some country, 42% of the graduations from the university are in the humanities. And I just, this is a new finding. I don't think you've seen this before, because through our analysis we've come in. And what we did, using the quarterly labor force survey, we looked at people in the workforce to see what kind of education they had and what kind of sectors they worked in. There are about 3 million people with a tertiary qualification of our 15 million workers, so 20% have a tertiary qualification. And 1.2 million of them have degrees, and 1.8 have technical vocational education. Now, the percentages on this slide gives us where are people with degrees employed. 50% of all the degrees in the labor force are employed by community social services, government services. And 25% are employed in the financial services. In other words, three-quarters of all graduates, both from the higher education and TVET, work in two sectors. And there's very few people in the other sector. So that we thought was an insight that could, which is new, that could inform skills planning. This is our website, and I would refer you to that. Chair, I need to take some direction. Can we go on to yep. Mike Rogan and Bongi will also do a presentation. Haroon was a little mistaken. Mike Rogan is another economist from Rhodes University, and will present to look at these pathways through education and training, and in particular will refer to the higher education sector. Do you want to present here, or you want to
if if you wouldn't mind just switching. Thanks, honorable members. I'll be selective in the slides that I present. So in a way, this looks at the other side of what Professor Barat presented. This is the supply side. So in addition to being a mismatch between the growth trajectory on which South Africa finds itself and the skills of the workforce, it's also fair to say that the workforce is underskilled. It's not supplying skills. The best way to look at that is by a global comparison. We have a relatively low tertiary enrollment rate. That's important because it speaks partially to the gap that Haroon just described, but it also, I think everyone would acknowledge, is a reflection of the way that large parts of the South African population have been excluded from meaningful opportunities in the past. So there's a different element to it as well. I don't think I need to spend time discussing our high levels of youth unemployment. We know this, some of the highest in the world. And I'm sure you're all aware of the sort of term which has captured our imagination in South Africa, the problem of NEETs among young people who aren't currently employed and don't seem to be on any track to skill themselves to help improve their prospects for employment. The next one, thanks. This is a fairly well-established statistic in South Africa. If you look at three different groups of young people, especially the first two, 20 to 24 and 25 to 29, we find that roughly or just under half of people in that age group aren't in any type of employment or education. The numbers are there. We know them well. It's what to do about it that's the real question. Thanks. And this is simply to say that there's a strong racial footprint. These are the most recent data available from the labor force survey. If we look at the in each one of those age groups, the bar graph on the far left are black South Africans, and the bar on the right of each cluster there are white South Africans. So we can see a huge print in the racial footprint on the way that people are assigned into this category of not employed or in education or training. That's persisted. And so there's certainly another element which is required when we think about how to improve skills. I think it's really important from this committee in particular to think about what we've set for ourselves as objectives. These are quite clear. We'd like to take the entire PSET sector, which includes adult education, vocational education, universities, technicons, to increase that by 150% by 2030. And if you just, it's easy to read that, but if you stop and think about what's going to be required to achieve that, really a lot of work remains to be done. And in particular, we're talking about vocational education. The university enrollment is supposed to increase by about 70%, but between 2015 and 2030, in other words, in the next 15 years, our target for expansion of the vocational sector is 350%. Really unbelievable numbers in terms of the goal we've set for ourselves as a country. Haroon also spoke about it's also a question of what people study, what type of skills they obtain. Slightly offensive for those of us with humanities backgrounds, but we're used to that in this debate. Just like all other countries in the UK and Europe, they call them STEM subjects. In South Africa, we call them the SET subjects. Our aim is to, by 2030, to change the balance of what young people study, particularly at university. So the department has a strong focus on moving the balance away from humanities towards the science, engineering, and technology subjects. We can debate that. We can debate how to do that, but that's clearly a policy objective we set for ourselves. Thanks. These, then, are just the raw numbers. So if we take those projections, we would apply those to these particular numbers. I think you can reflect on these in your own time, but you can certainly see the absolute level of expansion which needs to happen if we're to follow if we're to stay in line with our objectives. And by 2015, we were in particular already behind quite a bit in our goal to expand the vocational education sector. So quite a bit of work to do there, just in terms of enrollments. Thanks, Vijay. So as part of theme 5, just to summarize what we did through about 10 different research projects, we asked questions such as which young people access the various types of education and training available in our PSET system. We were particularly interested in what type of schooling background they came from, where they were in the country. We wanted to get a good profile to see where skills were coming from, and in particular, which groups of young people remain excluded from the post-schooling sector. The most difficult question we tried to address, and this came up in the earlier presentation with the Stellenbosch team, what happens to people when they leave university? We asked that question earlier in the context of are we creating our own academics and our next body of knowledge producers, but we can ask that from a number of different perspectives. So three or four of the studies in this theme try to demonstrate ways of trying to get at that question of what happens to people when they finish their vocational or university educations. And then finally, we tried to suggest what type of data we'd need in the future if we'd really like to get a hold of some of these questions. All of that's available on the website and in various reports. I think I'm going to leave it on this slide. I think this is, I've got a couple after this, but this is a really interesting study that came out of the LMIP from, coincidentally, colleagues at Stellenbosch University. They were looking at a particular group of young people, and in partnership with the Department of Basic Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training, for the first time we merged the databases together. So we actually linked the data from HEMIS to young people's ID numbers as they came through the schooling system. And we were able to follow and track each one of those individuals to identify who and who did not go to university. And I think we need to move towards this type of graph for all sectors of the post-schooling education system. We want to understand so let me just walk you through how it works. It's a little bit lighter than I'd hoped, so it's hard to see.
Okay.
The bottom row there represents 100% yes. of young people who started school in a particular year. And this one, it was the cohort that wrote the 2008 matric exam. Thank you very much. So out of that 100%, 60. Only about...
Yeah, the numbers drop.
So yeah, yeah. So you can almost sort of see this pool moving through a series of nets to see which one gets through and completes university. So let's just say the bottom row represents 100 young people who started school and should have written the 2008 matric exam. Of those 100, 60 actually wrote the matric exam.
37,
thanks, actually passed the matric exam, and this is of that original 100, remember. 12,
yes.
Accessed, of the 37 that's passed matric, 14 passed with a bachelor level pass, 12 with a diploma, so 26 were immediately available out of that original 100 to go to one of those two types of further qualification. 12 of that original 100 actually accessed university, 8 immediately, 4 sometime after their matric year.
6
actually completed an undergraduate qualification. And then of those, what's the final number
four.
There? 4. 4 completed a bachelor's undergraduate degree. So that's what happens with every 100 group of young people that start school. So this is interesting for two reasons. The first is that it clearly demonstrates where some of the blockages are and how we can begin to identify what needs to be done. And second, I think it really shows in a very transparent way how we can analyze what happens. If we use our data creatively and think beyond just higher education, I think we can get a much more accurate picture of how skills are supplied to the South African economy with this type of analysis. The reports, I think I'll leave it there. The rest would get quite detailed. But this is all on the LMIP website, and I would encourage you to take a look. There's quite a bit of detail as well. But yeah, there's quite a bit to say on the supply of skills as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Through this work, we hope we have administrative data presently, but this is about introducing a new data set to inform skills planning. We'll have a quick presentation because Bongiwe has also come from Pretoria, and through the LMIP, generated a different type of data set which looked at attitudes to work. So it wasn't just the people, the numbers that had certain qualifications, but how attitudes to work and how that can inform skills planning.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So I'll be speaking about the Public Attitudes to Work in South Africa project that we completed, and I'm not going to go into the details regarding the history of the project, but just one thing that I want to mention is that the conceptualization of this study was underpinned by a primary assumption that attitudes do matter in social policy. So we'll run quickly on the slide. Dr. Reddy has already indicated that skills planning discourses are typically too scientific or kind of mechanistic in trying to match the supply and demand. And we actually forget about the views or the agency of the actors who serve as the supply in the labor market, and forgetting that it is actually these very views and perceptions that influence the behavior that we see in the labor market. For instance, no matter what policy recommendations we come up with, they'll be doomed if the public does not respond positively. So this presentation therefore stresses the need for kind of critical and a deeper understanding of public perceptions regarding the labor market so that we'll be able to formulate the tailored employment and skills development interventions. So in the light, not just one on the top, in the light of the changing nature of work, employment shifts that the colleagues have spoken about, currently we really have very limited understanding of what the public wants from work, how they define work, what are their expectations and preferences and so on. What are the drivers of motivation of South Africans, and how are these views shaped? So such information is really important because it will add an important layer, you know, that will give us signals or insights into people's decisions regarding labor market participation or even participation in the education and training. Okay. Okay, so quickly, this is what I'll focus on in the presentation. The study was segmented into three sections. The first section sought to understand the public perceptions of everyone in South Africa, irrespective of whether they're employed or not employed. Then we had specific questions that were targeted for people that are in employment, just to hear more about their working conditions and evaluations and so on, and experience. And then the last section was targeted for people that are unemployed, just to understand, you know, their experiences, their attitudes towards work, levels of optimism about finding employment, and how they are searching for employment. So in this slide, what does the public consider is an important attribute of a job? In the study, we evaluated five aspects relating to work, whether the job is interesting, useful to society, and so on a five-point scale, ranging from very important to not important. Just quickly, the three things to note from the slide is that if you look at the agreeness, can't find the mouse. In the bottom, so if you look, yes, if you put in the first one and the second one together, so you come up with the agreement, so we're grouping the very important and important, you will see that all aspects of a job were highly rated. What does it tell us? It's telling us that almost all respondents actually acknowledge that the quality of a job is determined by a number of factors, and the variation is really visible if you only look at the people who said at the very important lines at the bottom. And the second thing to note is that job security was rated as very important by almost 7 out of 10 respondents, more than any other characteristic. So just one last point is that individual expectations from work, you can see from this slide that the expectations from work are much more complex, and, you know, they vary based on needs and preferences. Okay, we can skip. Okay, so this one, so the previous slide investigated aspects of a job that were perceived as important, and we saw that irrespective of employment status, job security came up as most important. This slide now is trying to compare what workers expected and the reality of what's happening in the workplace. So it's basically a continuation from the previous slide. And what we're seeing here is a clear disjuncture between what workers, you know, expect and what's happening. And this is so in relation to key expectations. You can see from the slide economic rewards, the issue of income from their labor, as well as upward social mobility. So what this is suggesting is that workers were a bit more satisfied with the content of their employment in terms of usefulness, good job security, and so on, than its ability to meet their immediate and longer-term material needs. Of course, we expect that there will always be a gap or a discrepancy, but the concern is only when the gap is wider between what the workers are expecting and what they are reporting as happening in the workplace. Okay. So in this slide, we're examining the perceptions about the prevalence of qualification mismatches about the labor market, and we'll agree that ensuring that worker skills and qualifications correspond to the job requirement is necessary, because it will ensure that available skills kind of are appropriately utilized in the workplace. So what this slide is showing us is that in terms of qualification mismatches, 51%, or just over half of the respondents, indicated that they are mismatched. It's either they are underqualified or overqualified. But what you should note is that both kinds of discrepancy, whether you're overqualified or you're underqualified, it represents some form of underemployment, because it's showing that somewhere, somehow, there is a misallocation of labor resources. And again, most importantly, is that while these are people that are already in employment, they have found positions in the labor market, qualification mismatches should be a cause of a concern for skills planners, because they are associated with a number of adverse labor market outcomes. Okay, this one speaks to issues of training. So having established that most of our labor force is mismatched in the labor market, to what extent are they have they been exposed to training? Okay, this is a very interesting slide, because it's showing that only about 60% of our people have attended training. And the previous presenters have already alluded to the fact that most of the work seekers are unskilled and semi-skilled. What's coming out here is that workers with low educational attainment are less likely to receive training. So the question is, how do we encourage occupational mobility in this context? Does it mean that employers need to upskill more? Okay.
the stunning thing is that those that have education get more training, and those that don't have.
I really hate what I'm doing now, because it's quite important stuff that you are showing to us. And if only we can have more time in this parliament, you know, to do a proper stuff like this. So I am pretty sure, honourable members, you've got questions, but I'm sure that you are also restricted to the fact that the bell is going to ring for us to go into the National Assembly with the President in the House today, yes. So what I wanted to suggest, I'm completely in your hands, honourable members, on engagement now, but with almost going to 2:15, we need to do justice also to the fact that you have come here, but justice on our side also of having a meaningful engagement with yourselves And I wanted to suggest that where are we now? It's the end of May. In about two or so weeks' time, the committee will have a what we call a committee week, where we're not constrained from 9:30 to 1 o'clock, where there's a little bit of a, you know, the sort of the whole day. And I wanted to suggest we should, if we can't, honourable members, reconsider in a day like that to RADA, because I think what's important is to receive responses from the members on what you have presented. Because for us, who are we? We are policymakers, we are legislators. So our thinking goes immediately, everything that you say, what does the legislation say about this? What does the policy say about this? And does this fit into this? Must we go and change the policy now? Must we go and change the legislation now on these things and currently what is happening? I mean, that's, for me, that's where our mind goes to immediately. And in order to come to those answers, there's got to be a meaningful engagement from all of us and a digestion, obviously, of what you present. So you want to assist us, Honorable Fikana?
I go along with you that there's no time now. We should come... They should actually come back, yes, in 2 weeks or during community room, but it should be before NC policy conference, because this is supposed to influence our NC policy conference. Areas of focus, just quickly. Number one, please, you see this story of we producing BAs, humanitarian, social, we've been hearing it for the rest of our lives. So you need to tell us, and we already know math, science, accountancy is where we must focus, and technology. So you need to say to us now, to improve our skills, these are the areas. We should avoid asking more questions. These questions have long, even the issue of manufacturing. Nkwame Nkrumah spoke about it in his books in the 1960s, and... otherwise, it becomes just a repetition, repeating the same question, problem. We need to come up with solutions. The last one from me that I think you should focus on, it is said the 10 fastest growing countries in the world, 6 are in Africa. Nigeria at 12%, Angola at 8%, Mozambique at 6%, Rwanda at 6%, there are about 6 of them. Now tell me why, when there's such a high growth as compared to us who are at 1.1 or 0 point something, why is it that all these people are crowded here in South Africa? What's wrong in their countries? Because it is growing 12% in Nigeria. But these Nigerians are here.
Your time has expired.
So you should come with an answer.
Thank you very much for your input. I don't want you to answer it now. I want you to go away with some of those things. That are, so essentially what we are saying, we are extremely thankful to come here. We must profusely apologize if we squeezed you into all of it. But I think that which you have presented and have given to us, we now have a time at least to go through the booklets and so on also. And then we really would want to have a proper engagement. Yes, I think the member is right. We are only ANC members now in the room. And so, yes, we're going to a policy conference. Of course, we are very interested to see Ms. Wimbeka and make some changes there. And I think we will engage with you before this. We will engage with you and just see how we can move.